Okay, so we're going to go, today we're going to talk about the A201. So we went through the B101, obviously extensively, and this is the I won't say companion document because it's the construction side, but it is the most used document, and the terms and conditions in this document, similar to like with the B101, are what you guys are going to see over and over and over again in your practice of architecture. You want to learn this document for a couple of reasons. One, because if you ever sit down and take the exam, you're going to be tested on this exam, on this document. Probably by the time you sit for it, it'll be the 2027. But while they do have modifications and change from year to year, or from every decade, there are not a lot of huge sweeping changes. There's a lot of these provisions that have been in there, and they're the same or very similar iterations for 30, 40 years. The other reason why, and it's probably more important towards your practice, is that you will be called upon as an architect once you get hired by the owner and you're doing the design work. They're going to come to you and say, do you have contractors that you can recommend? Or, I have a contractor, do you have a contract? And if you've entered into a B101 using the AIA documents with your architect or with you guys, you want to use the consistent document. You want to use an AIA document because all the terms and conditions are the same. If it's defined in one document, it'll be the same definition in the other document. There are other form agreements out there. There's something called the contract document or the consensus documents. Those are from the general contractor side. Obviously, the AIA, American Institute of Architects, these are favored toward the architects. Now, I won't say that they're heavily favored, but there are provisions in there that do protect you. We've talked a little bit about them in the B101, and I'll point them out again to you when we're going through it in the A201. There's one thing called the EJCDC that's put together by the Engineering Society. There's a Design Build of America, the DBIA documents, there are form documents. Those are, again, probably more architecture side, but they deal with if you're both doing design and build in the same contract. So, You have these different forms out there. You don't want to mix and match. You don't want to have an AIA architectural agreement and an EJCDC contract agreement or anything like that. So keep with your same form family. And so when you get out there, your owner's going to ask you to help with picking the contract. They may even ask you to help draft it. If it's a smaller project, you can indulge in them and work with them on that. As the projects get larger, and dollar value, it's my experience that you don't want your architect to be negotiating your contract for you. I've had, unfortunately, too many actions where the architect puts together the terms and conditions between the owner and the contractor, and then when things go bad, or badly, the contract that the owner has signed with the general contractor doesn't protect them as much. The architect doesn't have the skill set. They're not looking for those things that need to protect the owner because they're looking to protect themselves. Sometimes architects will even build into the A201 more protections for themselves but less for the owner. So architects do this. It's part of in your phases. It's the bidding and negotiation phase, so it's something you can get additional revenue for. Again, as the lawyer looking at it, it's not my recommendation that you negotiate the contract. You can put together the RFP, you can do a lot of things in the bidding and negotiation process, but the actual contract itself, what I would do is tell your owner, hey, I can help you with this, but you really need to get a lawyer involved to talk to, or someone else involved to help negotiate the contract between you and the general contractor. It also keeps the tension down. There's always going to be somewhat of a tension between contractor and architect because the architect's going to say, my drawings are fine. The contractor's going to say, no, they aren't. I want to get more change orders. The owner's wanting. So if you're not in there negotiating that initial contract, you're not starting that tension earlier. So that's just one thing but you'll want to know this document kind of and how it works. So, okay. We're going to start off, just like with the B101, there was the general provisions. Now, today we're going to get through the first five articles. There's 15 articles in it, and so you're like, how does that half? Well, the second back half goes a lot faster. So we're going to go through the first 15 articles, similar to what we did with the B101. We're going to talk about different provisions and what they mean to the ordinary person as opposed to just the legalese that are stuck in here. The first one we have up here is 1.1.1 under Article 1, and this is just the definition of the contract documents. And so we talked about that under the B101 as far as what the definition is. And this includes this agreement, conditions of the contract, supplementary general, these are the general conditions, drawing specifications, which the architect is preparing, addenda, if those things come up. And it doesn't include, what I have here highlighted, it doesn't include advertisement for the invitation to bid, instructions to bidders, sample forms, or other information. This is important in the sense that when you go out to bid for a project, when you're working with the owner and going out to bid for a project, you're going to have all this information and instructions and everything else that you're telling the general contractors. Here's what you need to know about this, you need to know about this, blah, 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 blah. And there may be negotiations during the course of that bid where things change. And so ultimately the contract that is finally signed, not the stuff that was part of the RFP process, RFP, which is called Request for Proposal, during that process, those don't, that information beforehand, don't become what's called a contract document. And as we talked about under the B101, contract document, capital C, capital D, is what all parties are obligated to follow. So if it's outside of the contract documents, you don't have to follow them. And so this is saying these things, sample forms and other stuff, are not part of the contract. I have had cases where we get into a project, we're starting to work on the project, and the contractor will come back and say, well, the RFP said I had to do A, B, and C. And you point to this provision and say, but you don't, because it specifically says the RFP doesn't count anymore. We're just looking at what is the contract documents, which is the drawings, the specifications, these general conditions, etc. The contract itself, it says the contract documents form the contract for construction. So you'll see the word agreement with a capital A, you'll see the word contract with a capital C, which is in this paragraph here. They are effectively interchangeable as far as what we're talking about. This is the contract, capital C, which includes all of the contract documents. And it goes through and it says it supersedes any prior negotiations. So if you weren't clear on the stuff that was in the previous paragraph that said all these prior forms and RFP and everything don't count, it says it again here. This is what we're using for this project. And it says, it should not create, one of the things that's important here, does not create a relationship between the contractor and the architect. So we go back to that triangle I talked about from the very beginning. You have the owner on the top. You have two solid lines coming down to the bottom corners of the triangle. On one side is the architect, and the other side is the contractor. What's between them is a dotted line, which represents that they have communication between each other, but they do not have a contractual relationship. Nothing, but the contractor does not owe any obligations to the architect. The architect does not owe any obligations to the contractor. The only time the architect would be part of that is if we talked about in the first part of the semester, the agency, and where the B101 says you have the authority to act on behalf of the owner. And in fact, so what that's happening here is if the architect does something in the bottom of the corner, it's really the owner speaking, because the owner's the principal and the architect's talking as their agent. So it doesn't create, this thing says we don't create a connection. It doesn't also, if you think back to that triangle we've talked about, you have the triangle underneath the contractor on the bottom side and the architect on the other side are going to be other entities below each one of them. And the architect, it's your structural engineer, your mechanical engineer, your electrical engineer, all those people that be below that. Under the general contractor, it's a bunch of subs. So you can have all those things. This specifically says this agreement does not create an agreement between the owner and the subcontractor. So if there's a problem with the subcontractors, the owner must go through the general contractor. And there's nothing binding between them. And then it says, same thing for the owner and the owner's consultants, which are going to be the engineers that are between them. So it's all establishing single point of responsibility. Owner, contractor, owner, architect, and then there are people down below. You talk to either the architect or the contractor on those. Any questions on that? Okay. The work, and we're just going to go both through these a little bit faster. These are, like I said, defined terms. The work is the actual construction work that's going on in the project, work with a capital W. So it has nothing to do with the architect services, which is a capital S. So we have services as the architect does, capital S. Work as the contractor does, that's a capital W. Now the subcontractors will be performing the work with a capital W. So that is something that that term, that defined term, will be flowed down. They call it a flow down provision, this definition, from the general contractor's agreements to the subcontractor's agreements. And there are a whole bunch of AIA subcontractor agreements, so the recommendation is that your contractor use those documents. So again, we have the same definitions going through. The project is, in this case, it's all of the work under the construction documents, and the project can include the owner's stuff. So we've talked about if you're doing a hotel and you have a specialized restaurant in that hotel, but the owner is bringing in that contractor and the architect to design that specialized restaurant, that still will be part of the work because it's part of the project as a whole. Contractor doesn't necessarily have obligations to that part of the project, but you want to think about the project as the whole, and the subset of the project is the work that the contractor is going to do. So with that restaurant hotel thing, you have contractors work with a couple of capital W, and you have the kitchen guy with the work with a capital W. They are two separate works, but they are all under the project umbrella. Drawings are what you guys prepare, so there's drawings, and it's a definition here that's defined. What's interesting about this document here is, and I think I may have mentioned it in the B101, so the instruments of service is a defined term in the AAA documents. It's talking about the drawings, the specifications, any other details, any other models, all the other media that the architect may create. What I find really interesting is that term is not defined in the B101, which is where it should be defined. It's defined in this document here. Same with like the drawings. You would think that that would be defined in the architects, but it's defined here. So that's why you also want to use these agreements in conjunction when you're working on a project, because there may be a defined term from one document that can only be found in the other, and vice versa. Question?
You kind of answered the question, but again, that's one thing I was just very confused about with B101, where we've been talking a lot about defined terms.
Yes.
And I'm expecting to see something as a poetic glossary of the defined term.
Correct.
Because it seems like, you know, that's what defined
term. Yeah.
I guess
many of them are here. Now, there are some in the B101. There are a few that you, as you read along and everything else, but the majority of them are here. And why the AA did that, I don't know. I mean, these documents have been around for so many years that it's just maybe this is the format and they don't see a need to define another term. I found, though, that what I always found was somewhat confusing to me. Drawings and specifications have been around forever. The term instruments of service didn't come into play, I think, until the, I don't know if it was in the 77. I know I remember it being in the 87. I can't remember if it's in the 77 document. But it had never been used before. So here we're introducing a term that was more expansive of all the services that the architect is going to be providing, because now people were coming in with computer renderings and there were so many more things. And I'm like, okay, here's the instruments of service. It's an architectural element of the project. Contractors don't create instruments of use services. They use them. And there's this whole Article 7 in the B101 that has the licenses and the ownership of the copyrights and everything else. I don't know why they didn't throw the definition in that one, but they put it here. So I've been to some of the committee meetings. There's actually, they meet on a monthly basis here in Chicago to go over and talk about these documents and then ultimately provide recommendations. Where Chicago, there's other cities that do that, have these little subcommittee meetings on the AA documents, and we provide recommendations to the AA. I've been to some of them. We've never talked about the location of the definitions, but somebody made the decision a long time ago. So you have the drawings under 1.1.5, specifications are 1.1.6, and then here 1.1.7 is where the instruments of service are. And if you look at it, and this is the other thing you're going to find between the two documents, and I'll point out a few more times today where some of the more important provisions are, they're mirror. So if you look at the instruments of service paragraph in the B101 in Article 7, it talks about what all is included in the instruments of service, but they don't define it specifically like here, but the language is mirrored. So you're going to find that over and over, and again, that creates consistency in construction documents and for contracting. 1.1.8 is this concept of the initial decision maker. Now, the initial decision maker is found it's talked about here in Article 4, we'll talk about a little bit later today, and there's a reference, to it in the B101. But the initial decision maker was, and this is something that came in as a defined term, I think in the 07s, I don't think it was in the 87s, but what the architect's role, as you remember, is the architect's hired by the owner, and they're supposed to be, except for the few times that they have the specific contractual authority, they're supposed to be a neutral. They're not supposed to be on the side of the owner. And so they're still paid by the owner, so there's going to be a natural proclivity to be on the side of the owner, to defend the owner's rights on change orders and everything else. But the document that's written, the architect, is an independent white hat type entity for a construction project. Obviously, if it's about their stuff, they want to protect it. And so in looking at trying to resolve claims, and so the AA, what's good about the AA documents and a lot of form contract documents is they want to put together a process. If we have a dispute on the project between owner and contractor, how do we resolve that without immediately going to court? So we have the steps. We have this initial decision maker step. But if you remember, it's mandatory mediation, and then you can select whether you go arbitration or litigation. That's the kind of process. And the point is we want to have communication between the parties. The best thing on any construction project is talking to each other, communicating, making sure you're putting your things in writing. But sometimes it doesn't work. And so sometimes also you're going to need someone to step in as that white hat, that neutral. And so the AIA, as they looked at the role of the architect being this neutral, they defined it. So they came in and they said, we're going to call them the initial decision maker, the IDM. And so that's what talks about in Article 1.1.8, in Section 1.1.8. And it says, they're the people that come in if there's a claim under Article 15. We'll talk about 15 in a couple of weeks. But Article 15 is the process by which a claim with a capital C is going to be resolved. Claim could also be thought of as a dispute. It's where there's not an agreement between the parties. And so what happens is in a construction project under the AAA documents, the architect comes in first and looks at the issue. Contractor says, I don't know if these drawings are proper, I need a change order. Or, owner, you have done this, I need a change order. And there's not an agreement on the dollar value or what the work is or what the problem is. And under the AAA documents, the architect's supposed to step in with the white hat to say, I'm the neutral and I'm going to make an initial decision. And we'll talk about how those roles work, but that's what they're supposed to do. And as you see, it says they're supposed to be rendered in good faith. And if the architect makes the decision, and this is actually interesting, this shows where the AA has stepped in this one, it's protective of them. If the architect makes a good decision as an IDM, initial decision maker, and the architect makes it in good faith, meaning they've done their work and done the homework and looked at the issue and made a decision, and that decision is wrong, unless they've gone way out of bounds and have been negligent in the decision, they are not held liable. And so this is where the AIA documents, as I said, there'll be times where they come in and protect the architect. This is one of them. Even though within a contract, in the construction side of the documents, here's a protection for the architect that they put in here. So you come in as a white hat, you may make a mistake, but it doesn't cost you, according to what this provision says. Question? Sure. Yeah, there's all different kinds. So let's say that I'll use my consistent example here. Of we had a three-bedroom, two-bath house, and now the owner comes in and says they want to make it a three-bath house. So nobody's made a mistake. The architect hasn't drawn anything incorrectly. And the architect draws it up and gives it to the contractor, and the contractor comes back with a price. It's going to be another $75,000, $100,000 to put this bathroom in. And the owner's like, that's crazy. There's no way the budget went up that much. I can't believe that. And so the contractor's like, well, this is what it is. So if you want to put it in, that's the cost. And this is what's going to affect our schedule and everything else. Well, you want the project to continue because they're still building the rest of the house. The owner still wants the third bathroom, but there's a dispute over the cost. So they're going to bring the architect to come in and try to get a clarification to see if those costs are really proper or not. And sometimes what will be, there'll be an agreement, what's called a constructive change directive, which we talked a little bit about. Oh, no, we haven't talked about that. That'll be next week, or 2 weeks from now. It's in Article 7. there'll be a directive for the contractor to keep working while we resolve the pricing. So that's a simple one. Sometimes it may be scheduled. Where it becomes a little bit more difficult is, let's say, and I'll give you an example of what I had in one of the projects that I had. So I had a project that was being built on an extended piece of land that went out into the water area. And so they wanted to have a number of large trees. It was a large open kind of pier docking thing that went out or whatever. And they can't plant trees because it goes out into the water area. And so the architect was supposed to design these large, giant basins that would set down into this giant structure, and the trees would grow in that. Well, parts of the design for how those operated and worked were then turned over to the contractors, subcontractors, that were making these giant metal, I think around metal or concrete, I can't remember which, and they had to do their own design work on it, and there became a dispute between what the architect was calling for and what was in the architect's drawings and what the contractor needed to install. And it was a significant dollar amount. It was like $4 or $5 million because it was a large space that they were doing here. So the contractor says, and the subcontractor on their side said, your drawings, architect, weren't sufficient. And this is what we came up with, and this is the cost. And the architect saying, you didn't read my drawings correctly. So now we have a dispute between architect and the contractor's giving a price and a solution that the architect won't approve, and the owner sitting up here saying, I want the project to continue on, and it's going to cost me more money, what's the solution? In that instance, and this is where the bias comes in, of course, is the architect, by contract, comes in and does the initial decision and says, no, my drawings are correct and you're not correct. And so is that really being a neutral white hat? So the concept of the initial decision maker is a good concept for certain instances, but there are other times where I'm not too sure that the architect is an independent neutral. Because the architect, and maybe the architect's drawings are bad. What do you do in that situation? So the architect says, my drawings are fine. It turns out that actually they were bad. Now the owner's got a dispute against the architect, plus the owner's mad at the architect for protecting their bad work. And so that creates... So there's sometimes when the initial decision maker is not, in my opinion, the best place for the architect to be, but there are many other times it can help. And it, you know, there's lots and lots of times where schedule and dollars and things like that, they can come in and resolve that dispute. So, does that help? Okay. All right. 1.2.1, the correlation intent of the contract document. So, remember we talked about, you know, the four corners of the agreement is what's in the agreement, which is the contract documents. And that four corners, I talk about it because we think about pages with four corners, but it includes the drawings, the specifications, everything that was on the defined term before. And it says the intent. So this is telling the court and telling the parties what the intent of this collection of contract documents is. To include all items necessary for the proper execution and completion of the work by the contractor. And that they're complementary, meaning that they should relate to each other. The specifications should relate to the drawings. And if there's some type of problem between them, you have to figure out which is priority. And we'll get into that in a little bit. So the contractor says, I have this universe of contract documents, and that's what I'm building the project from. Everything in here, and the intent is for them to work as a cohesive whole, and that's what I'm starting to construct. Where another dispute may come up is, as I've always said, architect drawings are not 100%. And so there's some reliance on the general contractor to say, well, I know how to build these things, so I don't need all of the drawings where every bolt goes or every nail is hammered in. So they can figure that stuff out. But sometimes maybe the drawings aren't quite as clear and the contractor needs more information. And so that's where you're trying to figure out what's in this universe and where the contractor may require that change order because your drawings weren't detailed enough in this instance. Or we don't know how to solve this problem because it's not just based on my experience as a contractor in the industry. I mean, sometimes it could be as simple as, because I've used this example, you start digging a hole for the foundation, you think the soil is solid, firm soil, and it turns out to be silty soil and it's mushy and everything else. Now the contractors bid the project with a certain type of footing and foundation and how the concrete's going to go into that, but the soil won't hold it, so they have to do other things. That's going to create a change order, and that may not have been in the contract documents. Why is this not going to the next one?
stuck. Is that moving there? No. Oh, here. Let's see if this works now. Okay, good. 1.2.1.1, this talks about if there's an invalidation. So these are some contract rules. And one of the things that you learn in law school is you learn there are specific rules about how all contracts need to be read legally. Like I said, defined terms. Everybody knows as a first-year law student, if you see a capitalized word in the contract, it's a defined term, you've got to find that definition somewhere else. And I taught you some of these things in this class this semester. But there's a lot of stuff that most people don't know, and obviously many people don't take this class. So they do rule out, or they do lay out some of the contract drafting rules. And that's what this 1.2.1.1 is. It says, if it's determined, this is a invalidation clause. So if it determines that any provision of the contract violates any law or otherwise is invalid or unenforceable, that provision shall be revised to the extent necessary to make it legal and enforceable. And the contract should be construed to the full extent permitted by laws to give effect to the whole intention and purposes of the executing contract. So sometimes you have a provision in there. Maybe you have a provision that's based on the code at the time that the drawings were created. And then the code changes. So now your drawings, which are part of the contract documents, are out of code. So you have violated the law. If they build it out of code and they know the code has changed, now you have a building that's in violation of the code. You don't want to have that happen. So this talks about, if that happens, you have to update the contract documents. It's not necessarily a provision in this agreement. It could be the drawings. It could be the specifications, all these other things. And the architect, if it, and this is something we talked about in the B101 in Article 6, if the code changes after the drawings are done, the architect does have to correct them, of course, but the architect gets paid for it. Because they're like, look, I did the drawings and I finished them on January 1st of 2025. If something changes later, that's not my fault, so I should get paid for fixing it. And under this, the contractor says you have to fix this. And so that'll go through the owner and then back down to the architect. 1.2.3, unless otherwise stated in the contract documents, words that have well-known or technical construction industry meetings are used in the contract documents in accordance with such recognized meetings. This is the kind of catch-all. It says, hey, contractor, there's going to be words in here that aren't defined and doesn't have a capital letter in it, but these are industry terms. You know, we all know what shop drawings are. We all know what, you know, samples are. There's all these things that are industry terms, and it says, hey, if you see an industry term, we all are going to have to take that definition for it. 1.3, 1.4, you don't have to worry about. It's more rules of how a contract works. We'll skip down to 1.5, which talks about the ownership of the drawings. It says 1.5.1, the architect and the architect's consultant shall be deemed the authors and owners of the respective instruments of service, including drawing specifications, etc. This is the language you saw in Article 7 of the B101. And so, again, this is a mirror image, protecting the architect and telling the contractor, hey, just because you're using these doesn't mean you own these and doesn't mean you can't take them to the next project. You have to follow the rules. And here it says here, because obviously the contract between the architect and the owner doesn't bind the contractor, so we have to stick that mirrored term into this agreement so the contractor knows the rules that are on the other side. 1.2, contractors, subcontractors, subs, and suppliers are authorized to use and reproduce the instruments of service provided to them, subject to any protocols established pursuant to 1718. Solely and exclusively for the execution of the work. So again, this is limiting, just like if you remember in the Article 7 of the B101, says, I'm going to make these drawings, and as long as you pay for them, you can use them for this project only. You can't use them for the next project and the next project, and if you do, you either pay me for the next project, or you have to release me from all liability. Here, what this says is, the contractor, you have the right to use them, because they've given you a license for that, but you can only use them for this project, and you can't do them for anything else. It's just for the execution of this work. And then notice, talks about here,
where contract documents require one party to notify the other, such notice shall be provided in writing. Now, the interesting thing about this provision is, this is a newer provision in the 2017. In the past, there would be provisions throughout the document that say, if you want to do this, you have to put notice in writing. And then another provision, you have to put notice in writing. And another provision. But not everywhere. And so what would happen is there were legal arguments being made when there wasn't the proper communication and it wasn't put in writing, where one side or the other said, hey, I didn't have to put it in writing because in paragraph 1, 17, and 35 said you had to put it in writing. This is paragraph 22, it doesn't say it. And one of the contract terms, one of the ways you read contracts is if it's specific in certain provisions and silent in the other, it doesn't apply. That's general contracting language. So if the AAA saw that and said, well, we're going to just put here the concept of any notice has to be in writing. So we put it once, and it applies to any time you see the word notice throughout the whole document. So crafty lawyers were using silence in certain paragraphs to win arguments, and the AAA came back in this version and said, we're going to stop you, crafty lawyers, because we always wanted everything in writing, but now we're going to tell you everything needs to be in writing. So that is a change between the 2007s and the 2017s. Notice of claims is provided in section 15.1.3. We're going to talk about that in a couple of weeks. Again, claim is a dispute or any type of disagreement between the parties that has bubbled up further. And it needs to be by certificate or registered mail or by courier with proof of delivery. So if you have a specific claim, you have to follow these rules. This is notice plus. Like, if you send an email, it's not going to be sufficient. Now, often, because in this day and age, this will be a provision that one side or the other will request it to be modified to add in, must be addressed by email, certified or registered mail, or by courier provided by other proof of delivery. I don't like changing this, because if you're going to make a formal claim, I would like them to go to the next step, because if not, then you have to read every single email where somebody's saying I should be paid this or that as a claim. Claim bubbles it up to I got to call in the independent decision maker. It slows down the process of the project. So my position as a lawyer, and if you guys are ever asked by your owner, well, what do we do about notice here if there's a claim, my recommendation is to keep it as required here as opposed to just an email shouldn't be sufficient. 1.7, digital data and transmission. This provision and the next one, 1.7 and 1.8, were modified in 2024. Even this is a 2017 document. They were modified in 2024 because they referenced a couple of other AIA forms that nobody ever used. And so those forms have been out for about 8 or 10 years. People never used them. They were very complex. And so the AA said, we're just going to get rid of them as the specific form you need to use. And they just kept the intent of the provisions in here. So if you go back, you may see an earlier version of the 2017. It'll have more language in these two paragraphs. It won't be tested on that part. But the point here is that sometimes they tweak things when the AA realizes nobody's following me, so we're just going to get rid of them. That would happen here. But the intent of these two paragraphs is 1.7 is to say, if you are going to be transmitting documents electronically, which is pretty much every project now, you should put together a protocol of what happens when those documents are transmitted. Because there can be degradation. There can be some documents don't come all the way through. And if you think about the complexity of what's going on in your CAD documents and all the multiple layers of when you're drawing things and everything else, there could be problems with that. And so that's why, like, most projects will always have what's called a stick set, which is actually the drawings actually printed and they're hanging off of a long stick and they hang in these racks. So you actually have the paper to look at them if there's a confusion. That's part of the protocol. So what you want to establish in the beginning of the project is say, if something goes wrong with the transmission of electronic documents, here are the steps we need to follow. That's this digital data protocol. And the building information model and use and reliance. Building information modeling is BIM. You guys may have heard about BIM. There's also Revit. There's other different types that are out there. So this is talking about, and again, it had a form that you used if you're going to do BIM. They've gotten rid of that and just talked about if you're going to do it, you need to have a discussion with the owner, the contractor, the architect of how BIM is going to be part of the construction process. As the lawyer negotiating these terms, I rarely get into the details of 1-8. Sometimes I get into the details. I have an exhibit that I use for 1-7. I normally look to the architect and the contractor to communicate independently about how BIM or whatever is going to be, you know, the project website or how the communications and the modeling is going to be for the project. So this will be something you guys probably will do more than I do. And it'll by the time you guys start practicing, maybe the way they use BIM will be different. It changes so quickly. But this is a provision that kind of more applies to you guys than just negotiating the contract itself. That's the end of Article 1. Article 2, just like in the B101, we had different articles talk about the different obligations between the owner and the architect. Same thing here. So we're now going to talk about the obligations of the owner, that the owner owes the contractor. And you'll see some provisions in here that'll be reminiscent of what the owner owed the architect, or the language there that it carries across for consistency between the documents. First one, you got to have a designated rep. It was the same type of provision in the B101. It should be the same rep. The person that's going to be the person that talks to the architect all the time should be the entity or person that's going to talk to the contractor all the time. They're going to be the one that the contractor knows when they go to them. They have the agency and the authority to act on behalf of the owner as a defined term. The owner is up above paying the bills. And it says they have express authority to bind the owner's approval or authorization. So that's going to be, and that's why you want to have the owner's rep talking to the architect as the same as the owner's rep talking to the contractor. It would be really a nightmare. I mean, you can have one or two people up there, but you don't want to have a situation where one rep approves something with the architect and it doesn't make it to the contractor, and the other rep doesn't approve it to the contractor, and then you have this dissension between what's been authorized or not. 2-2, evidence of the owner's financial arrangement. So this is an interesting provision, and depending on which client you may have and who you're working with, they may want to strike this. So there's a lot of times where you have private owners, or maybe you have a corporation that says, I don't want and need to give you my financials. Like, I'm a huge company or whatever. I don't want to have to deal with this. Contractors, on the flip side, are saying, well, God, if I'm going to do this project, I'm going to do this $50 million project, I need to know that you can pay me. Like, because I'm going to be putting out a lot of money. I'm going to be buying materials. I'm going to be hiring subcontractors. I'm going to owe them money for wear work and everything else. So I need to know that this project is properly financed. And so that's what this provision is here, is it says, before I start working, and this is the provision that's protecting the contractor, I'm allowed to ask you if you can pay me. And you have to show me something. Now, you can get into negotiations about what it is. Like, if it's a public company, they can say, you can look at my public filings. You can see whatever is that's going to go out to my shareholders, stockholders, but they don't get into the details and the inner workings of the company. I work for a lot of private individuals, and they have LLCs or what have you, and so we may give them a bank statement that we're working with a lender, but we're not going to give them the financials of us. It says, hey, here's our bank. Here's where the approved loan is. That should be sufficient because the bank is sufficient and we have the loan with them and that's enough money. But you're not going to see my private financials. You're not going to see the financials of my company. So there's all different types of negotiations that go on here. Question?
So in this provision,
yeah.
It's saying that the contractor has the right to ask for those things.
Correct.
Does the owner have the right to refuse that?
So what happens is, and when I'm in negotiations with the owner, is I will ask them before I send a draft to the contractor. I will alert them of this provision and the next provision, which is a companion provision, about this. And then I'll have a discussion with them of what information they want to turn over. Sometimes they're fine, and they're like, they don't care, and so they will provide the information. Sometimes what they'll say is, well, we can keep this here, but we need to tell them what we're going to give. And so they have, it's part of the negotiation in the beginning, because this is part of the beginning, but is something you should, and again, there are going to be many times in your careers where I will never be involved. No lawyer will ever be involved. The owner's just dealing with you, and they're going to be relying on you to help walk them through this construction contract. This is one that I would raise to them, especially if you're working with private individuals or private companies. How much of your information do you want to have out there? And so you can, so the answer to your question is, if it's written like this, the term coming in about what they can say no to is based on this term reasonable evidence. So they can say, I want to see all your books. And you say, that's not reasonable. Here's my bank statement that says I got a loan. That should be sufficient for you. And that may be a negotiation if the contract's signed without any edits. Sometimes the contract is modified that says, you can ask for only this, and so I'll do that with them. And sometimes I have a number of clients that we've stricken these provisions entirely that says, if you want to do business with us, you do business with us. You don't get to see anything. So I have, and those are clients, big and small. I mean, I've had small clients and I've had huge multinational corporations that says, no, they don't see my records. And if they want to work with us, they got to trust us. We're multinational. We're worth, you know, X billions of dollars. So it all depends on how that negotiation. But it is a recommendation to raise this Article 2.2 with your owners if you're brought into the space, to explain to them that this could be a question. So 2.2.1 is before you start working, and it has to be reasonable. 2.2.2 is after the project is started. So now you got this project, you're doing a $50 million project, and you get, you know, the owner's got, like, let's say the bank loan is only $35 million, the owner's putting in $15 million of their own, that money's going through, you've got enough part, everybody's cool, the owner's good, the contractor's good, you're building it. Maybe there's a huge change in the economy, or maybe, and it's affecting the owner's business, maybe there's a significant change in the project. It goes from a $50 million project to an $80 million project, or $60 million, or whatever it might be. This is after, and so the contractor is going to raise their hand again and say, hey, can we still keep doing this? I see you're getting crushed in your business. Is the bank going to call your loan or whatever? So this is another step where they say, hey, we can come in and make sure and ask yet again to make sure that you can fulfill your obligations, but it gives some more narrow, limited times. It says, one, if you fail to make a payment, then they can ask. So that's one. Two, they identify reasonable concerns of the owner's ability to make the payment when due. So your business is failing, I read about your company, whatever that. Or three, a change in the work that materially changes the contract sum. So if it's a $50 million project and it goes to a $55 million project, I would argue that's probably not material, but maybe a 60, maybe a 65. What in that material change of the price is, what is it going to be to put potentially the contractor's funds, outlays of its own money at risk? And so, again, this is a provision that you want to make sure you tell your client that this could come up during the course of the project. Make sure you make payments on time. If we make a major change in the project, they may need to come back and ask you to modify or to provide additional information that shows financially you can do this. So, 2.2.3, after you give the financial information, the owner shall not materially vary from such financial information with a prior notice to the contractor. So if the loan agreement is being modified or changed by the bank because maybe it's a revolving line of credit, whatever that might be, but if there's something that happens that changes the cash flow, and a material change that cash flow, the contractor needs to know about this. The owner has to notify that there's something going on. And this provision, so these are provisions that, if you go back 30 years, were not in this document, but you look at it now, and there was enough times where economies went down or things happened that the contractors raised their hand and said, we need this language in the agreement. One of the things that I may have told you in the past, but this committee that I sometimes have gone in and sat on, it's made up of multiple representatives. So there's going to be attorneys from subcontractors, attorneys that only represent owners. There's going to be people that only represent architects, people that represent large corporations, small corporations. So the input that goes into this document is not just from the architect's side. They specifically make sure that everybody has a voice at the table. And so when something comes up, you look at this provision 223, you know this is a provision that a contractor lobbied for hard. And it's a reasonable one to say, look, I need to be able to know this information, and it's not just if there's a change in the economy. If the owner starts changing their financial world, I got to know that, because they don't. If without this, they wouldn't have to tell me. You know, then all of a sudden they don't have any money, or the shoe drops, whatever it might be, and then I'm out. So you don't want to be in that situation. Question?
So you check the first one, you check all these.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So if you went to get, it depends on who the owner is. So if you went to go work for Microsoft and they struck these provisions, you would not be alarmed, and you wouldn't say no because you want to work with Microsoft. If you went to work for mom and pop bakery down the street and they struck these, you may be then a little bit more hesitant about it. So there's business sense that comes into it. And you know, if you go and you're building a house for someone that's worth, you know, $100 million. They're not going to give you any of their financials. They're going to strike these. And they may say, fine, don't work with me. I got 20 people lined up to work with me. So this is a market-driven agreement and provision. And so depending on who has the leverage and who wants the project built, sometimes you'll find where the way business is going, the economy is going, or the construction industry, which sometimes is a precursor. What's interesting about the construction industry is as the economy, it actually is ahead of the economy. It drives the economy. So as construction gets better and better and there's more work, then the economy catches up. And then as the economy starts dropping off, the construction stays slower. So as a profession, it doesn't have nearly as many highs and lows as the traditional economy. But you'll find sometimes in busy times where you have that, maybe not Microsoft, but maybe a national or international corporation, where they want to strike this, and the contractors say, absolutely not, you can't strike that. And you're like, well, I'll go to the next contractor. Well, there aren't that many contractors out there because everybody's so busy. So when you're in a situation as a general contractor where you have 15 projects lined up, you can tell the owner no. Say, I need that provision in there because I got 15 more people that will give me their financials, and I know I'll be fine. So again, it just depends on who's on what side. So 224, when the owner is designated furnished under this section 22 as confidential, the contractor needs to keep that information confidential, and that's going to happen almost all the time. You're either going to stamp it confidential, or there's going to be a transmittal that says the information is here is confidential, because it is their financial records, and so they don't want other people to know what's going on with their business. So this is the pushback. The owner says, okay, I have to give you this stuff, but I don't want the world to know this, so you have to keep it under wraps. And if you don't, there's penalties and violations that you may have to pay us as a result of a violation of this confidentiality term. 2.3, information and services required of the owner. So the owner has to provide stuff to the general contractor. How can we know what the project is? And we need to give that. So it says under 2.3.1, the owner shall secure and pay necessary approvals, easements, assessments, charges required for the construction or occupancy of permanent structures, blah, blah, blah. So what this talks about is I have to give information and I have to pay for and get a hold of things like, if my property is, let's say you're building on a landlocked piece of property, so there's other properties all around it, it's in the center. You have to get to that property by putting in a driveway. That driveway goes over somebody else's property. That's called an easement. An easement allows you to use someone else's property for that. The owner has to pay for that easement. The village or the city or the municipality has to be notified of the easement. There's all these things that have to go through. Those requirements are on the owner, and they have to provide that information. Approvals. Maybe there's an approval that they need to be able to build a certain type of structure in this area. Maybe there's a zoning change that has to happen, and you have to get the city approval for that. Maybe there's lighting. Maybe there's setbacks. Whatever happens to go in, those approvals that have to happen, the owner is responsible, and they have to pay for that. Now, the owner, what they'll probably do is they may turn to the architect and have the architect do that and work with the city. Or they may hire an owner's rep to work with the city. The owners may not actually secure them themselves. But ultimately, as far as the contractor is concerned, is I'm not the one that has to get the building permit. I'm not the one that has to go out. Well, the contractor will get a building permit, but I'll explain that in a second. I'm not the one that has to get the easements. I'm not the one that has to get the city approvals. You need to get those, and you need to pay for them. And that doesn't come out of my cost of the work. That's not in my bid. You have to pay for that. So, there are times, I think I told you when I represented Navy Pier, the vice president of construction there, they don't want to take responsibility for a number of things like these, like surveys and other stuff that owner would normally have. So when they entered into the contracts with the architects and entered into the contract with the contractors, they changed this provision that said, you are fully responsible. We will pay for it all, but you need to do the surveys. You need to do this investigation. I don't want to have that responsibility. And they put it off, and those were additional charges and risks that both the architect and the contractor took. But it turned out to be beneficial because sometime later during one of the investigations, it turned out that they discovered thorium in the soil. There had been a factory back in the 20s and 30s that manufactured watches, maybe even later, I don't know how long it stayed there, manufactured watches. And if you remember, before we had watches that lit up, you would sometimes have with a glow-in-the-dark dial. Well, that glow-in-the-dark dial, years and years ago, the glow-in-the-dark the treatment was thorium, which is a radioactive material, and that's why it would glow in the dark. And then ultimately the EPA outlawed it, but during the course of this project, of this plant being built, they had waste, and they would just throw it in the soil. They'd throw it out, or some of the waste would just go through the drains, or as they're wiping down the floors, or all the stuff. It wasn't like they intentionally buried it there, but there was a whole bunch of thorium in the soil. And so when that happened, Navy Pier turned to the contractor and said, you were supposed to discover this because I turned these things and obligations over to you. So that's a provision that you can modify, but is the general AA document, the owner needs to secure and pay these types of things. 232. This one's pretty silly, but you want to make it sure. It says, you shall retain an architect lawfully licensed to practice architecture in the jurisdiction. I mean, of course you're going to do that, but it's in there for a reason. This provision is here because there obviously were plenty of times when an owner didn't hire a licensed architect in that state or that jurisdiction. They had their buddy do it. They had somebody from another state, whatever it is. And then when things went south, there was a collapse or there was a project problem with the projects, things got shut down because the city inspector came in or whatever might have happened. Now the contractor's sitting there, got all these people on the site that aren't getting paid. Nobody's working. The project's not going on. And so they're like, because you didn't hire an architect, the right guy, the right woman, or whatever it is. So this says, hire a licensed architect. Like I said, simple, but it's fair for a reason. So, moving on to 234. The owner shall furnish surveys describing the physical characteristics, legal limitations, and utility location of the site, legal description of the site, and the contractor should be able to rely on the accuracy of this information. So, plot a survey. This is where the meets and bounds are. This is where your land is going to be, and you can build in this area. And I know that, and this is really critical in Chicago or any major metropolitan city, is if you think about, like, look where we all live. And look at all the buildings. I mean, they're right next to each other. You mean, you have buildings where they touch each other. And if the survey's not properly, and you dig into somebody's property because the survey's not correct, now you're trespassing, now you've violated their soil, their whatever, you may have weakened their building, and so the contractor's like, hey, the survey you gave me said I could dig into this area. Now you're telling me I can't. So this says it's an obligation of the owner. You have to provide this information. I need to know where the utility lines are, because I can't see underground. Nobody on my construction team has x-ray vision. So what you do is, owner, you and architect have to go to the city and find out where ComEd has laid their lines or whatever, or you call Julie and they come out and they check and take a look at it. I mean, when we had a fence put in into our house, we had to call Julie because we wanted to make sure when they were not digging the fence post that they weren't going to hit a power line or a gas line or whatever. So the people come out and they do spray painting from whatever the utility is and tells us where they can dig our fence poles. So Julie is an acronym. I don't know if you guys have heard, or it's an abbreviation. I don't remember what it stands for, but but Julie is the organization. It's like, I think if you call 711 or one of those types of numbers, I think it's 711, then they will, Julie is a state, and they'll bring somebody out, or they will notify all the utility people in the area to send out during a period of time. So I don't remember what each initial stands for, but it's for the people to come in to tell you what's underground. So the owner needs to take care of those things. Owner shall furnish information and services required to the owner by the contract documents with reasonable promptness. The contractor says, I need my survey, I can't just start work on it. You have to act. If you just sit around and not do anything, well, those costs of delay are on the owner. That's why there's provisions in here. So, and the last one in 324, or 234, reliance on the accuracy, they just say, what you gave me, I'm taking as gospel. I'm going to say that this is accurate. So if there is a survey that shows where a gas line is, and they dig with their backhoe and they rupture a gas line in an area where it wasn't supposed to be, contractor's not responsible. Owner may not be responsible either, but the contractor certainly is, and it's because it says we can rely on the accuracy. Years ago, probably 30 years ago, I got a call from one of my partners. He was a partner then, I was just an associate. He's like, we got to get up. They had been digging, tearing down some of the projects that were like at Division and, not Lincoln, Clybourne. Division and Clybourne, there was a bunch of projects that used to be there. And they were tearing them down. And they had a survey where the gas line was. And that gas line wasn't there. It was where they were digging. And it just ruptured. And there was this huge plume of flames going up for like 3 hours before they could turn it off. And so that was where one of the questions was, were the surveys accurate? And what information did the contractor have, and who had to pay for all those delays because the contractor had shut down and everything else? So, 2.4, owner's right to stop the work. This is an important provision. And this is something that I have used on construction projects and consulted with architects on construction projects. Not a lot, but more than many other provisions in this agreement. There's a lot of provisions in the agreement that never come up. They're important for negotiating the contract, but this is one. This is where there's a situation where you have problems with the work. The contractor's not performing timely. The contractor's putting in terrible work or crappy work, and they're not fixing it. You've gone back to them. You've worked with the architect. You've tried to get a solution to all these problems, and it's not working. And so you, as the owner, are in a situation like, what do I do? I'm going to need to stop the work to fix this because I don't want it to get too far down the road. And as the owner, you have the money and the right to do that. This specifically tells you that you have the right to do that. Now, it's a dramatic, drastic move by the owner. It's not so much as the nuclear option, which is termination of the contractor, which we'll talk about in a couple weeks. But the right to stop work is a risk, because, especially if it's a larger project, because what you are stopping means there are going to be a bunch of people sitting around charging an hourly wage. You know, if you have a subcontractor, a plumber, and you shut down the plumbing work, that subcontractor still should be paid for the time that there are people on the project site, because you, as the owner, have no relationship with the subcontractor. You're telling the general contractor to shut down. General contractor tells the sub, not my problem, I didn't do it, the owner did. The sub's like, well, I got all these people that should be paid for their job. So it's a big deal to stop the work. It's something that I have used sometimes as a threat. Look, if you guys can't get your act together, we are going to exercise 2.4. But sometimes I've sent a 2.4 letter that gives them a 7 or 10 day period of time to get their act together, and they do that. So it's a tool that you can use. And so the owner may talk to you about this at some point in time, where they come to you and like, what do I do? What do I do? Well, you 2.4. You go to that, you do this. It has to be in writing, and you need to state why that work is being stopped. So you have to say, and so I have had projects where, like, I had a very large project where there was problems with the with a very complex plumbing system, and there was problems whether they had the right sizes of the pipes, the right drainage system, a whole bunch of other stuff.
and it wasn't working. And the owner was beside themselves of what to do because they had gone back to the contractor and gone back to the contractor, and the subcontractor couldn't fix it. They brought in another subcontractor. They couldn't fix it. The contractor was legitimately trying to fix things, but they couldn't. And the owner was like, this is going to cost me hundreds of thousands of dollars if we keep going back, and I have to get this company up and running. We had to open the doors of the facility, et cetera, et cetera. So we issued a 2-4. We stopped the work. We brought in our specialists, had already investigated everything else, and we said to the contractor, and we exercised the next provision here, which is 2-5, that we had the right to carry out the work. So we stopped their plumber, which was their second or third one in the scenario. We said, don't do it anymore. Not only are we not going to do it anymore, but we're going to exercise 2.5 that says we're going to take over this scope. Now, the contractor was really upset with us, and they said, we're going to charge you, and it's not our fault, and everything else. And we ultimately showed them what was wrong, and we fixed it ourselves, and it cost us more money, and we then backcharged. We, instead of the contractor coming for us for money, because he had to pay his subcontractors, we went to them and said, you have to pay us more, you have to give us more money back, you have to pay us, because we shouldn't have had it brought in. But these two provisions, 2.4 and 2.5, are something that the owner may come to you as an architect from time to time and say, what do I do and how do we keep this project moving? I'm at my wit's end. And so you can exercise the notice to stop the work, and under 2.4 you can take over the work. And here, it gives again some more structure. If they default or neglect to take the, carry out the work in accordance with the contract documents and fails within a 10-day period after receipt of the notice to commence and continue the correction of the default, then you can bring in your own people. So sometimes you issue the letter under 2-4 and you give them a period of time, so that may stop the work. Or maybe you just do 2-5 on itself. You don't use 2-4, you do 2-5 on its own. But you have to give this notice period. It has to be in writing. And if the contractor makes legitimate efforts to just start to try to correct the project, you can't bring your people in. So this is built in to protect both the owner and the contractor, the way the language is. There has to be a default or neglect by the contractor. The owner has to give notice. And if the contractor starts up again and is acting diligently and reasonably, owner doesn't step in. But if that doesn't happen after that 10-day process and we're not moving along properly, the owner then can come in and finish it out. And then it says at the bottom, if current and future payments are not sufficient to cover such amounts, the contractor shall pay the difference to the owner. And if they disagree with that, then they can bring a claim under Article 15. So how this works on a project is, let's say we have a line item in the bid for the plumbing for $300,000. We're $150,000 in, and we've paid the contractor $150,000, leaving $150,000 left owed to the contractor. Work's not getting fixed. We tried to fix it and fix it and fix it, and we exercise 2.5, and we hire our own plumbing contractor to come in. If that plumbing contractor can do the job for $150,000, no money changes hands between us and the contractor, stays the same. If the plumbing contractor that we bring in costs $200,000, we go back to that expectation. We expected to be able to do the whole thing for $300. We paid $150. We owed $150. We had to pay $200. Contractor now owes me $50,000 because we paid $350 for something we did for $300 because we had to pay the $150 plus the $200. If they come in under, if our person comes in under the $150, then there's an argument that the contractor may say, you owe me money. You owe me additional funds. That will never, will rarely fly, because most of the time when you have to bring somebody in, almost every time it's going to cost more than what you originally bid on it for a whole host of reasons. But there is language that says you may have to still pay the contractor the $300 because that was what the contract amount was. Or the difference between if it cost $140, you would pay the contractor maybe $10, potentially. Any questions on that? One there. Sure. So what happens is if you come in and take over the work, it says, shall not
give rise to duty to the owner to exercise this right for the benefit of the contractor or other person. So you don't do it to help out the general contractor to stop the work or another entity. You do it for yourself. Okay? Then it talks about under 613 of why it happens. So, like, you can't do it depending on, maybe some projects have different contractors working on it. You can't do it for the benefit of the subcontractor. So that's what it says for there. Okay? Any other questions on owner's responsibility? As you can see, there are not a lot of responsibilities for the owner. The big guts of this document, the largest pair of provision, similar to like the B101, which is Article 3 of all the services that the architect had to provide, Article 3 for the contractor is the largest section in this document. So we'll go through that now. So in general, this talks about, it defines the first one under 3.11, it defines what the contractor is. And then it says under 3.12, they're going to perform the work. So the contractor's not doing the project, the contractor's doing the work. The work is a subset of the umbrella of the project. And that's why when we get into this term, and it comes back now, maybe this will help you link the connection, why it's always called the cost of the work. The owner has a budget for the project, and under the owner's budget for the project, that big umbrella is, how much should I pay for land, how much do I pay for lawyers, how much do I pay for the architect? It's everything under the project. But we get to the work, and that's just what the contractor's doing. So when we're looking at the architect's agreement, and their costs are based on the cost of the work, this is the work, capital W here. It's the work the contractor's performing. 3.13, the contractor should not be relieved of its obligations to perform the work in accordance with the contract documents, either by activities or duties of the architect in the architect's administration of this contract. What does that mean? So when we get to Article 4, the next one, it talks about what the architect's going to do during the course of the project. Now, none of that Article 4, as we've read in the first initial information, nothing when we get there, creates a duty between the architect and the contractor, unless there's those couple agency things. There's no duty between those two parties. And so what this provision says is, I'm a contractor, and I need to do what the contract document says, regardless of what the architect's doing on the project. The architect can do whatever they're doing on the project, running around doing all this other stuff. It doesn't change my obligations as the contractor under this contract. I still have to do everything under this contract. And then you're going to see, there's going to be language in here that talks about authority of the architect, but it's only the authority granted by the owner, is what we saw in the B101. So there will be some times when there's some obligations, but those are truly obligations coming from the owner, because the architect is acting as the owner's agent. So never does the architect act on its own and instruct the contractor or change the way the contractor holds its duty is under this agreement. Does that make sense? Okay. 3.2. Review the contract documents and field conditions by the contractor. Execution of this contract by the contractor is a representation, meaning I'm saying I agree to this, that I have visited the site, I've become generally familiar with the local conditions under the work is performed, and I've correlated personal observations with the requirement of the contract documents. This is an important provision because there are actually contractors that sign contracts that never go to a project site. And then if something's different about it, they can't say, I didn't see this or I didn't know this. In fact, this says you are representing that you did visit the site. You made personal observations. And you correlated those observations with what was in the contract documents. So let's say I got that survey of where the electrical lines and the power lines and the gas lines and everything else, the sewer lines are. And I had the survey, and I had that as a document that I'm supposed to be relying on. Remember, it says I can rely on the accuracy. And if I go out to the project site and I see a sewer at the end of the street is a different spot than where it's on the drawing, then I know that there's a discrepancy between what I have as documents and what's really in the field. If I see light poles or if I see other things that give me notice as a contractor that understands what I'm looking at, that is different from whether it's the soil survey, whether it's the survey of what the utilities are, whatever it is, I have represented under this provision that I've looked at it and I've made a connection between the two, and that I can go ahead and perform under this contract documents. So that will happen from time to time. Contractors will find out, they'll go to the site or they won't go to the site, and they're not required to do their own survey to see what's underground, but they can make general observations of where things are, and they can see that this is right and this is wrong. And so that's important to make sure when the contractor comes back and says, hey, I have to dig a different hole because the hole I was starting to dig turns out it has a pipe in it, and your drawing said I could do a pipe, I could dig there, but now I can't. But if you can see that it leads straight to a sewer line, then you say, you know what, I'm not going to pay for that because you represented, you went out and looked, and you should have connected the dots for this. Contractors can't be completely like, see no evil, hear no evil, say no evil. They can't be blind to this stuff. 322. Because the contract documents are complementary, meaning they're all supposed to work together, the contractor shall, before starting the work, carefully study and compare various contract documents relative to that portion of the work, as well as information furnished by the owner pursuant to 234, which are those surveys and easements and everything else, shall take field measurements. Actually go out. If it shows me that this is the plot of survey and this is the boundaries of the land, I take field measurements to make sure that's there. Sometimes they'll be different. Like we have sitting in my yard, there's a metal stake that comes up in the part of my front yard. It's like in a garden. That's my property line. And it's got a little orange spray paint on it because somebody's come out in recent years or whatever and surveyed that. So that's something they know. That's the end of my property line. Those are all over the place. Sometimes you'll see, like, you may see this walking on a street corner, like downtown. You may get to a corner where a building is. And if you look down into the concrete, you may see a brass medallion, a circle or a square that'll have an X on it. That's where a survey spot was taken, and that's where the edge of that street, that corner is where the property is. And maybe that's where, at one point in time when they were building this building, where the guy with the survey said, took all their survey shots. You've seen those things, those, like where they look through the machine and it's on the pole. And that's where that brass marker is. So there's all these different things that a contractor, when it comes out to the site, should be looking for and comparing those to the surveys and information provided by the owner. And it says, these obligations are for the purpose of facilitating coordination and construction by the contractor and are not for the purposes of discovering errors, omissions, or inconsistencies with the contract documents. So you're not... The errors and omissions, and this is a language... errors and omissions is language you're going to see throughout construction and architecture. When you see errors and omissions, it's going to apply to the services you perform. If you see the word called defect, that's to the construction work. So a contractor does defective work. An architect has errors or omissions. And so when they're talking about it here, remember there was that provision that said industry standard terms, we're all going to agree with this. It says, I'm not supposed to be looking at the errors or omissions in the drawings, meaning I don't have to check the architect's math. I don't have to make sure they drew their things properly because that's what errors and omissions fall into. But they still have to have general observations. And so this is a provision that is written is protective of the contractor. I'm not the architect, so when I'm looking at all these things and walking around, I don't have to see the errors and omissions. But then the provision flips back and it says, however, the contractor shall properly report to the architect any errors or inconsistencies or omissions they discovered or made known. So I have my survey. I'm walking around the project site. The survey was prepared by an engineer, or I have my plans, some drawings and specifications prepared by the architect, and I'm walking around, and I'm comparing what I have in my hand to what's the land that I'm going to be building, that the property we're going to be building this building. I'm not looking at the property and looking at the drawings to make sure the architect did their job right. That's not my job, to check and correct their math. But if I do see something, because I'm an experienced contractor, and I see that, that's what the however is, if I do see something, or someone tells me, then I need to raise it up. Then I can't hide behind it. And so this is where we have a provision that, in the beginning, talks about the architect is probably an owner-related provision.
Then in the middle, it's protecting the contractor. Then the back end, it goes back and protects the owner and says, you got to make sure you, if you saw it, if you see something, say something. So this is a provision that is drafted over the years. I haven't gone back and looked at the whole history of this, but you can see how a provision is created where we're protecting one entity, we protect the other one, but we have to keep it reasonable. That's why this however is. If you saw it or somebody told you about it, you got to raise your hand. So, and these are some of the provisions that come up in litigation because you find out, what did you know? In this course of weeks, I talked about in the anatomy of a lawsuit, if you remember, there was this one section about discovery where we send written questions and we ask for documents and we take depositions. That's where you find out if this however provision kicks in. Did you know about this? What did you look at when you were at the project site? Did you see A, B, and C to make sure that there wasn't this problem? I'm not sure if this is exactly applicable, but I had a case over 30 years ago, maybe just around 30 years ago. I worked on a renovation of Navy Pier, but this was an earlier renovation of Navy Pier. And there was this woman who was there, and she was taking her daughter, I think, to the Children's Museum. Daughter or son, I'm not sure which. She got in a cab, she had her car, and she was dropping her child off. And then she needed to go up to a 24-hour sale at Marshall Fields. So she needed money. And she ran in with her child and double parked her car in front of Navy Pier and hit the cash machine to get her money. And then she ran out to get to her car because she had to get up to Marshall Fields for the sale, whatever it was. And as she was running out, there was the regular doors that opened, and then on each side of the doors were full pane glass. And at eye level, there was a sticker, Navy Pier sticker, in each one of these glasses. She ran right into it, broke her nose. So she sued the contractor and she sued the architect. I represented the architect, that said, swear to God, this is what the lawsuit was about. There were skylights in the main lobby area. And the theory was the skylight, as the light came in and the fountain that was outside and the way the light hit, she couldn't see the glass. And that the glass was designed improperly and the whole thing put it so it was a dangerous situation for her. And she was suing for $40,000 because she had to have a nose fixed and all sort of stuff. And the contractor was involved. And some of these provisions about what the obligations are and who knew what and everything else. And then in the course of discovery, as we were getting documents, well, the security guard from Navy Pier took a bunch of pictures, like her face and the area and stuff. And this ended the case. We were in her deposition, and I had just gotten the documents from Navy Pier's attorney, because I was representing the architect, and they had the Polaroids. And literally right next to the circle sticker, like in the bottom right-hand corner, was a smudge of this woman's lipstick, because she hit it so hard. So I put this down in front of her in her deposition, and I'm like, so are you saying that you didn't see the sticker? Because it was right at eye level, and she ran right into it, and we got out of the case. But there was, at one point in time, the architect and the contractor were all fighting each other. Did you design it right? Was it at the right height? Did you put it in the right space? And all this other stuff. And it's not necessarily about this one as far as the site conditions, what they saw, but it was an interesting thing about where the architect and the contractor were battling against each other as who was at fault for this situation. And it turned out it was actually the woman because she ran right into the sticker that she saw. So, anyway. Okay, 323. The contractor is not required to ascertain that the contract documents are in accordance with applicable laws, statutes, ordinances, etc., but they shall promptly report to the architect any nonconformity discovered or made known to the contractor. So again, if you remember in the B101, you have to design in accordance with the codes and laws. That's your job. And so this says, not my job as a contractor. I don't have to do this, and I don't have to go back and check that, is this in compliance with BOCA? Is this compliance with the Chicago Green Code? Is this compliance with the City of Chicago Building Code? Is this whatever it is? I don't have to look at any of this stuff. I build what you give me, and if it's wrong, that's not my problem. It's not my fault, unless I figured it out and I know that because I've been building things for a long period of time, and or someone told me, then I need to raise my hand. So again, it's a protection for the contractor, but the contractor can't be completely see no evil, hear no evil, say no evil. If they see something, they need to say something. 324. If the contractor believes that additional cost or time is involved because of clarifications or instructions to the architect issues in response to any of this stuff. So if we have questions, where the contractor says, hey, your drawings don't match, or I saw an inconsistency, that's 323 and 322, the contractor shall submit a claim as provided under Article 15. And if the contractor fails to perform the obligations under 322 or 323, the contractor shall pay the costs and damages. So what this says is, if I see a discrepancy and I raise it, I don't have to raise it if I don't know it, but if I become aware and I raise it, and that changes the drawings, they're out of code, now you redesign it, now I have to build something different, I get paid for it. I can get a change order and I can get an extension in time. If I have to dig the hole differently because it's not consistent with where the underground utilities are, I get more money for that. But if I don't get, and if I don't get paid, I can bring a claim for it. But if I don't do it, if I don't follow my obligations under 322 and 323, meaning if I knew about it and didn't say anything, and that's where that discovery comes in, what did you know or not know, then the cost of fixing it falls to the contractor. Now, that's always a difficult scenario, is trying to prove a contractor knew about a defect in a drawing or an error or an omission in a drawing, as a correction there, not defect, or the contractor knew about a discrepancy between the site and what was in the drawings. It's difficult to prove that. Sometimes it's open and obvious. So this provision doesn't often come into play because it's sometimes difficult to prove a negative. How do you prove that you didn't know it? Sometimes it's difficult. But there are times when you can show an open and obvious situation, where you can show that anybody that was acting properly should have understood that this wasn't in compliance with the building code or what have you. And if the contractor failed to raise their hand and there's a problem, then you could put some blame on the contractor. Architects still may be at fault, but the contractor can't say, not my problem. So this is, again, keeping the contractor from the see no evil, hear no evil, say no evil. Questions on that? 3.3. Supervision and construction procedures. So this talks about what are we going to do to manage the project. This is an obligation. It specifically defines what the contractor is to do during the course. They need to supervise and direct the work. They need to use their best skill and attention. So in this, it's different than an architect. The architect's an ordinary architect doing ordinary stuff. The contractor, because they're actually building it, has to use their best skill and attention. Now, it's best skill of a general contractor that works on houses, that they're building a house. They don't have to act like a contractor that's building a nuclear power plant, but they have to use their best skills as a contractor. So this is a little bit higher, and that's why contractors give guarantees and architects do not. So this is a very big distinction between the obligations under the B101 for an architect to the owner as a standard of care and the obligations to a contractor. So it goes further, and this language you may remember from the B101 in the opposite. This says that a contractor shall solely be responsible for and have control over construction's means, method, technique, sequence, procedures, and coordinating all portions of the work under the contract. You guys remember that means method language in the architect's agreement? This says, and they say, we have no responsibility to means methods. I'm not going to care how you swing a hammer or crank a torque wrench or everything else, because that's the contractor's responsibility. Well, here this is acknowledging it. And they are solely responsible. So the owner can't be tagged for this, the owner's rep can't be tagged for this, the architect can't be tagged for this. It's the contractor's job to make sure that these things are taken care of. So this is a very, very important provision. This is as important as 2.2 in the B101, which is a standard of care. This is the mere important provision for the contractors, how they perform their work. I was in a very, very, very contentious lawsuit on a very large project where the work by the contractor was terrible. It just
so many areas of the work was so substandard, and the owner didn't understand it. The owner didn't know how poorly the work was done because the owner was just an average person. Litigation went all the way through into hearings, went to trial. This was a big provision where we put this in front of the general contractor, the head of the general contractor, and talked to him about this very provision. And he knew that the work was terrible. But he danced around this. I'm not sure what this means. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. You tell me what it means and all sort of stuff. But it's pretty clear that you are the only one responsible for the means and methods and techniques and sequences and procedures of this project. That's it. You have the job to do. You can blame it on your subcontractors, but that's a problem between you and them. As far as I'm the owner, I look to you as the general contractor, and you have to take care of the whole project. And if subcontractor says they did the work fine and you relied on that, and it's not fine, you're responsible because of this provision. If the architect makes a payment, even though the work is not fine, they're still responsible, regardless of what the architect did. So that's a big deal. And then it says that the contract documents give a specific instruction concerning the means, methods, techniques, sequence, and procedures. The contractor shall evaluate for job site safety and shall be solely responsible for the safety of such means, methods, and techniques. So there can be times when an architect tells the contractor how to do certain work. You don't want to normally do it, but there may be things where there's an instruction about it has to be at this load or this percentage. And so that's part of the means and methods. It doesn't happen often, but there's sometimes when they do that. And even then, if there's an instance where there's instructions of how to do something in it, the contractor still has an obligation to make sure it's performed safely, because they have to evaluate the job site safety. And then they determine if such means, methods, techniques may not be safe, the contractor shall give timely notice to the owner and the architect and propose alternates. So, hey, you want me to build this structure. Maybe it's a newly designed truss system, and you need me to install it. The way you designed this new system, I don't know if it's safe. So you have to tell the owner and the architect of that, and maybe even come up with an alternate solution. And that's keeping the communication and the cooperation. But if you go ahead and build it and you know it's unsafe, then you have some liability there. And then the architect has to evaluate the proposed alternative. And unless they object to this alternative here, the contractor shall perform the work using the alternative means, methods, and techniques. So sometimes the contractor, in this case, says, I don't want to build it this way, I'm going to build it this another way. And that solution, if it's not objected to, will be acceptable under the contractor and under the owner from based on this provision. Questions on this? Yes?
So in the case of the work staff would still then, it's like in that case, the contractor is still on the hook for that stuff, but that might be a completely different thing as the owner goes after the architect.
Correct. Correct. So I'll give you an example. A specific example. I had a case where there was a large span of windows, and there was a number of them. They opened up and cranked out everything, probably, I don't know, 15 feet? And so you have to, and then there was structures above it. So above those windows, you have to have some type of support to support the structure above it, because the windows themselves are not structural. Glass isn't structural. And so there had to be a certain depth and width to the beam that went across these windows. The design had it was 2x6s or 2x4s. Structurally, it wasn't strong enough, and so there was a bowing, and as a result, the windows didn't open. The architect designed that and showed how the connections were supposed to be, and the contractor built it. Now, the contractor in that instance didn't come up with a different solution, but during the course of the deposition, they said, well, of course, this should never have been built this way because it's not safe to have this long length. And as soon as they said that, then we were like, you then saw this design. You knew from your own experience in construction that the span and the weight above it, that the members you put in were not sufficient. You didn't raise your hand.
And so now we have an architect that's got a defective design, or we have a contractor that became aware of that defective design, built it, and then the defect resulted in a Boeing situation, and we had to rip it out and put in a steel beam. And that was the solution. So the owner, all the owner cares about is who's going to pay for the ripping it out and putting in the steel beam, who pays for it. And so the fight was between contractor and architect, who's primary, who's secondary. Is there, you know, you have to end the split of that, and that becomes the question sometimes for the judge and jury, who's more at fault? Is the architect because they did this? Is it the contractor because they didn't raise their hand? Who's first, who's second? And that comes down to the question of the trier of fact. I don't like the architect, or I don't like the contractor, or whatever it is. So that's where the situation can come into play. 324. If the contractor believes that the additional cost or time is involved because of the clarification, so the architect gives instructions to you, you raised your hand, the architect says, come back and do this, and now the contractor says, if there's additional cost for that, and this is similar to like going back to 323 and 322, the contractor shall admit the claims. Wait, is this a repeat? Did I go back? Hold on. 323. Yeah, I went the wrong way. Sorry. This is where 3.3. This is where we went through, right? Yes. Okay. 3.3.2. Sorry. Contractors shall be responsible to the owner for the actual omissions of the contractor's employees, subcontractors, or agents, employees, etc., etc. This is the single point of responsibility concept I talked about. Owner has, because of that earlier provision in this document, owner has no agreement with the subcontractors. So the owner can't sue the subcontractors. There's some language in here, there's some language I added to a contract that talks about intended third-party beneficiaries, you don't have to worry about it. I try to protect my owner and give them a right to leapfrog over the contractor if necessary and go after the straight subs. It's not an easy thing, it's hard negotiations, sometimes they get it. But the normal course is what you're seeing here is, I contractor am responsible for everybody I hire. So the owner can come to me only because of this provision, doesn't have to go after everybody else. I'm responsible to you, owner, for everybody that's underneath me. And there's a similar provision, I think, in the B101 on this.
Any questions?
Yeah. So that's a great question. And so the question was, is if there's a problem, and if the plumber, wouldn't it be better if the owner could just go straight after the plumber instead of having to go through the general contractor? So, there can be times when you would think that's the most beneficial, but what ends up happening is the contractor is going to make money off the subcontractors. So I'm going to bid a job for $30 million, and in there is going to be my profit, my overhead and profit that I'm going to make, 8%, 10%, whatever I built into my schedule. Subcontractors are going to bill me for their work. And it is in a lump sum provision. There's going to be one area where they're going to bill me for their work, and I have to pay them. But I may make markup on their stuff as well. And we'll talk about that in a couple of weeks on Article 7 where the markup comes in. So the contractor doesn't necessarily want the owner to know the details of their costs and everything that's going on with their subcontractors. That's number one. Number two, again, management of the project. If you are a contractor and the owner now has the right to go straight to the sub, then who's given the orders on the project? And so some other stuff goes wrong in the project, because one thing the contractor can't give up is the coordination aspect. I'm working in a room where there's going to be runs of electrical and HVAC and plumbing. And we have to have only so much space in this soffit where you're going to be running all this stuff. Contractor has to work with the architect to coordinate that there's enough space. And if the owner's given instructions straight to the plumber about where to run the lines, then, and it doesn't fit, then you have a fight between, well, did the contractor properly coordinate the work and everything else. So they'll become logistical nightmares. I will say this, in that case that I was talking about where we had the general contractor and he was talking about that one provision about best means or a best skill and effort, and he was diffusing and everything else, all he did was to point to the subcontractors and say, well, the owner talked to the sub, and it wasn't true, but they were trying, when they finally got to the end and they knew they were going to get tagged, that they tried to put everything off between the owner and the sub. The owner knew this, the owner talked to this and everything else, but that's not in reality what happened. The contract is what it is. So that's why you wouldn't want, as a contractor, the owner leapfrogging over you.
Another way also that's a problem is, let's say I bid the job for $30 million and the owner has the right to go to every one of the subs and start talking to them. And it says, well, how much did you charge? How much did you charge? How much did you charge? And they get all their charges together and it turns out that it's $22 million. And you find out that the general contractor is making $8 million on this project. I'd go hire all the subs and fire the general contractor and just work with them. So now you have a contractor that's been fired for termination for convenience. I don't like you. I take all your subs and we build the project. So you want to protect your interests. That's why a general contractor wouldn't want that. So the reason why the owner wants to have that way to get around them is because sometimes the contractor can be obstinate. Sometimes the contractor's gone bankrupt. There's all these potential reasons during the course of the project that maybe they are a really good subcontractor. I've had projects where a good sub is working on a job, but the contractor's not paying them. So they're like, we're not going to show up for work unless you pay me. And I, as the owner, is like, but I like your work. I want you to come in and fix it. So I leapfrog, if the contract's written properly, I leapfrog around and say, I'll pay you to do your work if you finish it out. So that helps an owner. You don't want to exercise that a lot because then if something goes wrong, the owner's the general contractor and they take on responsibilities. But that's two sides to both coins of why you want to do or not do that. So any other questions? That, yeah.
The question was just an example, like the architect got like $15,000, so they had to hire two different people for the same job.
Yes.
Would that be a similar instance in that case? Because, like, you technically always pay for the work for the contractor, they're just not paying the subcontractor.
Yes, so you would be able to get, if you had to go, so let's say that the plumber was getting paid $100,000 and you've already shelled out $90,000 to the general contractor. So you think that the subs only owed 10.
Right.
And you call up the subcontractor, and the contract that I've written or whatever allows you to go around, you call up the subcontractor, and I'm like, why aren't you showing up? I like your work. He says, because I'm owed $50,000.
Right.
If you pay $50,000 to that sub, now you've paid $140,000 on a $100,000 project, you would argue that you were owed $40,000 by the general contractor.
Okay.
So even if it's the same one, like in the project, in the question on the exam, we hired a different one. But in this instance, it's the same party, but if you have to pay more, and that becomes a risk. So that's one of the things that you advise the owner. You may be paying twice for this work, and sometimes the owner's like, but I need to get it done. So I'll pay for it twice, and I'll litigate it out. I'll go back to the contractor. Or the next payment to the contractor, I'm going to withhold. And when we get to Article 9, there's a provision in there that allows you to do that. So you can hold money back when you've wrongfully had to pay for other stuff. So, 3.4 just talks about labor and materials. We don't have to get too much into the 3.4.2, except if there's minor changes. If there's substitutions, you only can do that with the consent of the owner and by the evaluation of the architect. So, sometimes, you know, you're getting and you can't find this type of product. Maybe you have like a steel stud and it's a certain gauge and that gauge isn't available because the supply chain isn't there. Can you substitute it? Well, maybe, but you need to get the architect's approval. So unless it's minor, then you got to go and get approval for substitutions. And that happens on every project. Sometimes you just have to substitute something in and out. Sometimes it's the color. Maybe it's a paint product. Maybe it's small things. You don't have to get the approval. But if it's bigger, go talk to the owner and the architect. 3.4.3, the contractor shall enforce strict discipline and good work order among the contractor's employees and other persons carrying out the work. This is to make sure, well, again, this is like, well, of course they're going to do this. Well, this is now an owner's obligation to the contractor. I had a project years and years ago where it was this large industrial building, and there was some problems with the schedule and some of the subcontractors. I don't remember which trade it was, but it was the one trade that consistently was not doing sufficient work for the project. And during an inspection or walking around the project site, one of the owner's supervisors found in a kind of a, I don't know what you want to call it, a pigeon's nest, but it was building, it was like a room on the top of one of the buildings. And it was like, it had a refrigerator, it had beer, it had all this dope in it, and everything else. And so these guys were going up and drinking and getting stoned before they did work, which is not a good thing, because it's on a construction site. Or maybe they were doing it after the job. I don't know. But this provision, you can say, well, this isn't strictly good discipline for your project site. So they would, the contractor in that instance is a violation. Contractor's going to go to the sub, probably terminate them, or we would ask them to be terminated. But this is a provision that says, you know, of course you're going to have a good project and everything else, But sometimes the simplest things, like you have to hire a licensed architect, or here you have to have strict discipline, you still need it in the contract so you can raise that flag if you need to and point to it. So, yeah, I remember seeing the photographs when I came to me as the attorney, because there was other problems that I remember seeing. So I'm like, nice little den, guys. So they were, the sub was terminated. I can't remember what discipline it was, but they were off the site. 3.5, warranty. So warranty is that magic language that architects don't ever want to use. But contractors must use warranty. Now, there's two warranty provisions in the AIA document. There's this one, which is kind of like a generalized warranty. And then there's, like, when you buy a car, you get a one-year or a five-year warranty. When you get a roof, it talks about, that's in Article 12. We'll talk about that in 2 weeks. It talks about what the specific terms and who gets the warranty documents, that actual, maybe it's a physical document, and how long they are. This is a general statement of the work that's being performed. It applies to all of the work. And in this instance, so it's not warranty as in I hand you a warranty like a car warranty. This is a warrant, a statement, a representation. And here it says, I warrant to the owner and the architect that the materials, equipment shall be of good quality and new unless the contract requires permits otherwise. Now, like, so everything that you're building with has to be new and good quality. You can't just come in and bring anything you want. Now, where would be there a situation where it's not going to be new materials? Of course, it would all be new materials. Well, I had a project for a homeowner that they wanted distressed wood, and they found a specific barn, and they had the barn torn down, and that was the wood that the architect made them use for the floors, and they had to find all the right pieces of wood that fit in the floors. So that's obviously not new, and lots of it wasn't in good quality, but they were able to use the distress. So there's sometimes when you want to bring in an old piece, some structure from somewhere else, so that would be in the drawings. But if not, this is a representation and a warranty that I'm using all new stuff. And if you use used stuff, you're in violation of the contract. And then you also warrant and represent that the work, capital W, will conform to the requirements of the contracts and will be free from defects except for those inherent in the quality of the work for the contract documents. Free from defects. That's like it has to be. It's absolute. If there's a little defect or a big defect, it's outside of the warranty. As opposed to on the architect's side, you are not guaranteeing anything. This is a guarantee and warranty that what I'm doing is new, good, and free from defects. Unless it's that distressed wood, which is going to have knots and chips and everything else like that. I mean, that's the easiest visual example, but for maybe stuff that allows you to get away with some defective material. Question?
So, like, sometimes when you buy new materials, they still have, like, defects?
Yep. Correct.
So, like working with wood, when I like change the wood, I'm like, yes,
yeah, no. Yeah, get rid of it. And that's why that's a really good question. Is I have an action that I worked on for many years, and there were literally hundreds of linear feet of molding and trim that never should have been installed in this building. And what's supposed to happen is, so they take these long pieces of wood, they mill it at the shop, the site ships them out, and you get all these pieces of wood, and they're all stacked in pallets and everything else. And you look through it, and if they have knots, and if they have grains and everything else, or if it's warped, you throw it away, and you do another one, and you throw it away, and you put up the ones that are good and new quality. And sometimes the quality for project A is fine, but for project B, because it's higher end, is not fine. And so you have to also have a subcontractor that knows the difference between good wood and really good wood, and they know that I'm working on a project that requires really good wood. And if it doesn't, and you have corners that warp or whatever like that, that's all defective work, and that's all violation of the contract, or at least as me representing the owner argued. Question?
So in that example, when the contractor or subcontractors ordered
this
material. Yes. Does the number one, do they always order extra in case of that? And if they don't,
So a good contractor for, you know, if it's going to be materials that could have defects like wood and other stuff, I mean, if you're getting PVC pipe, you may have to order some little overage, but if you have something that's a natural material, a good contractor is going to over-order, and that will be paid for by the owner because the bid includes the over-order cost. And so the contractor isn't like, I need 100 linear feet and only orders 100 linear feet, and then when they throw out 30 of that linear feet, they're going to have to pay. The contractor has to pay for the additional 30. They can't go back to the owner because the owner said, I paid for what you got. So the contractor should build that into the price, but sometimes the overage is too much. So it depends. Sometimes the contractor will make more money on that, or they'll have extra. So another project I worked on, this is very tragic. It was one of those really fancy log cabin homes. It was a $1.4 million log cabin. And the contractor had built log cabins all over the Midwest. And they would over-order, because that's what you do. And so the homeowners would do that. And all the extra materials, they would ship back to their site in northern Ohio and keep that. And they had a storehouse and everything else. And they would use it from time to time. Instead of having to go back to ordering new, they'd come something else. So some other project paid for it, and they brought it in. But what do you know, if it wasn't some of the times, sometimes they over-ordered and they didn't throw away materials. They had extra that were good. That's the stuff they kept. Well, when they built my client's house, they basically built half of it from their warehouse, and not all of it was good stuff. And so we were able to prove that they were not building new material for our project. It had half new material, and half came from other old projects, and that's why. And that was one of the violations based on this provision. So sometimes the contractor will make money because they have extra stuff. Other contractors will have to spend more money because they didn't have proper overage in order to enough. Did you have a question or no? Okay. Now, the contractor's warranty excludes, so you have this warranty that everything's new and good and perfect and free of defects, excludes remedy for damage or defects caused by another, abuse, alterations, work executed by the contractors, or improper, insufficient maintenance, improper operation, or normal wear and tear. So, if I have a warranty, and I warrant that this pump that's going to be working, or this, let's have an air conditioning system in your building. The air conditioning system is new, and it's going to be used properly. It should be able to service the building and everything else. Well, if the owner doesn't do proper upkeep during the year of that warranty, and then the air conditioning unit is defective, the contractor can say, I don't warrant that during that period of the year because you still had to keep it up and running. At another project, there's a federal courthouse out in Rockford that I've gone for a number of hearings. And years before, one of the contractors that we got in a lawsuit with built a large portion of that building. And there's like a lobby area where you walk in. It's like, I think, two stories, but then the building goes up like 8 or 10. And so there's this kind of... It sticks out. I don't call it a portico or whatever, but so you can walk on that roof area. And so what happened is that it had a very specific metal roof system, and then there were other construction workers, maybe masons, I don't even know, that they were working on the main building going up, and they were walking on the roof. And so it had all these dents and everything in it. And so the contractor, we came back to the contractor and said, this roof is defective. And they're like, well, we didn't do that. Somebody else did it. And we said, well, you as a contractor should have protected this project site, so should have put down boards or whatever, so we were able to get from the contractor. But the subcontractor didn't owe anything because I don't give... So the subcontractor is going to give the same kind of warranty as the general contractor. This is another one of those flow-down provisions. But in this instance, the subcontractor said, I gave a warranty, my materials were new and good and defect-free, but you let somebody walk on it. So... and so the contractor had to pay for that because of their bad overall site management, but the sub didn't. Like, that's the normal wear and tear or anything else. So 352, all material equipment or other special warranties shall be issued in the name of the owner or transferable to the owner. So contractors going to be subcontracting. They're going to be buying materials. They're going to be talking to everybody else. And those warranties from the sub will be made to the contractor. Those materials being supplied, the warranties will be made to the contractor because that's who they have a contract with. So it'll be a very similar provision.
The owner wants to make sure that they are transferable or assignable to the owner. So subcontractor gives a year warranty on this material. Contractor wants to make sure they can give the year warranty to the owner. That's to help the owner if during that year period, or like let's say it's a roof, a lot of roof warranties are 10 or 20 years. General contractor may not be around anymore, but the company that supplied the roof would be. So the owner owns the warranty and it's in their name as opposed to the general contractor, so the owner can call the roofing company directly for the warranty. So to your question over here earlier about, isn't there a reason where a contractor would want to be out of that loop? Warranties may be that reason. Sometimes the general contractor will say, hey, if it's a problem with that pump, why don't you go to the pump and don't bother me, I'm doing other projects. So after the project's over, by this provision here, 352, the contractor would like to step out of the disputes and let the owner talk to the subs directly, and that's a common occurrence. During the course of the project, because of management, you don't want everybody running all over each other, but afterwards, in warranty issues, this provision will be a more logical way to solve the problem. Okay. 3.7, permits, fees, notices. So this talks about, these are some of the permits that the contractor has. As I said earlier, when the owner was securing certain things for easements here, this talks about the owner. The contractor gets the building permit because it's going to be in their name as the general contractor and the owner, but the owner still has to pay for it. Owner has to comply and give notices required by laws. So 3.7.2, you got to follow the laws as a general contractor. 3.7.3, if you, as the contractor, perform stuff that's contrary to the building code, contrary to the laws, then they're responsible for whatever problem comes because of that. So that's the kind of, if I knew something, even if the architect drew it wrong, I still have responsibility under this because I, too, am outside of what's required under the building code or what have you, so long as I know that. 3.7.4, concealed or unknown conditions. This is if you see things at the site while you're digging that hole and you find out that, oh, God, this was an Indian burial ground, which was happened in McCormick Place, the original McCormick Place that's on the lake. When they dug that up, it turned out where they originally were going to dig it, there's an Indian burial ground. So they had to actually shuffle that thing and they had to move the graves and everything else. It's an unknown and concealed condition. If you didn't know it, if they differ materially, you need to promptly raise your hand and say, I found dead bodies, or I found this this pipe under here, or whatever. You have to stop what you're doing to make sure that you don't continue to work in this area. And you got to call the owner in, and then the architect shall promptly notify the owner and the contractor, and then you talk about whatever recommendations. So this is really where, especially because it's the property, if you want to think about it, an owner, one of the things the owner's supplying is the property. The contractor's building above it, maybe it's a big hole. So the contractor's building the new stuff on the property, so that's what the contractor's responsible for, the construction. But anything on the property that's concealed, contractor's like, not my problem. I'm going to stop work if I found that dead body or if I found the pipes or whatever it might be. And then you turn it back to the owner and say, it's your property, figure it out. You and the architect, let's figure it out. And then we move forward. So that's what 3.7.4 talks about. Let's see if there's anything here. This one actually does talk about burial markers, archaeological digs that they immediately stop. So this actually calls out 3.7.5 specifically for that type of, you know, Indian, like I said, what you have in the McCormick Place. 3.8, allowances. I'm going to cover this very high level. Anybody here know what an allowance is? Okay, so let's say you are a homeowner and the architect, you hire an architect to design your beautiful home. And the architect says, hey, we start picking up like the colors of your paint colors and your carpets and your other stuff. And you're like, okay. And then they come and they say, well, we need to do your kitchen appliances. And you're like, oh my God, there's too many things. I'm not really sure and everything else, but I really want a really high-end kitchen. Do we have to make that decision right now? No, we don't. We don't have to make that decision right now. We can figure that out later because it's going to be inserted in. You don't have to worry about it. Contractor's like, how do I bid this? Because I'm going to be buying the refrigerators and the dishwasher and everything else. So you establish what's called an allowance. I'm going to put a plug number in, $15,000 for appliances for the kitchen. whether it's Sub-Zero, whether it's Frigidaire, whether it's Wolf, whether it's GE, I'm just going to put in $15,000, and we're going to call it an allowance for kitchen appliances. Allowances happen all over for all different types of materials in construction. When you don't know the specific quantity or you can't identify the item, but you need to have a number in the bid. So you are looking to the architect and the contractor to have a reasonable feel of what this allowance should be so your budget isn't busted. And so when you build that kitchen and it turns out that the appliances were only $10,000, you get $5,000 back because you never paid that $15,000. It's just sitting there as a placeholder. You only pay for what you build. But if it turns out that the appliances are $18,000 or $20,000, that allowance has to be increased, and so you have to pay the full price. So it's simply a placeholder. It's an allowance for an item or a series of items to plug in for a contractor. And so this provision, and this is all you need to know about this for purposes of this class and test, this provision talks about that it's an allowance and what they can use it for and how they use it, but that general description of what I said is all you're going to need to worry about as far as the test is concerned, but it's a placeholder. Superintendent, this talks about somebody, so the owner, the contractor is going to have their own representative, but they're going to, and that's probably going to be a project manager. Below the project manager is going to be the superintendent. Sometimes they are the same people if it's a smaller project, but the super is the one that's on site all the time. And they're the ones that are directing traffic between all the subs and coordinate everything else. So the superintendent is the everyday on-site person, and they're going to identify here. And they will be able to speak and be an agent for the owner or for the contractor. So you may have a project manager that's an agent for the contractor, and you have the superintendent. They are speaking on behalf of the contractor. Contractor, let's see if we have 392 just talks about if there's if you have to replace someone or who's going to be the superintendent. These are some provisions in here that talks about 392 and 393 talks about if you have to swap out people or who's going to be approved. You have to at least give the owner notice of, here's my superintendent, here's their qualifications, we're going to change them out. Do you agree, not agree? Did you have a question or no? Okay. 310, submittal schedules. So what you need to know for this, and let me see if there's anything specific, and we'll go through the numbers on this. So in a construction project, everything's sequential. We're going to work on this, and then this, and this. We're going to dig a hole, then we're going to pour foundations, then we're going to put up steel, then we're going to put up wood, and then we're going to put up brick, and then we're going to, so it all has to go in sequences. And as you go along, you have to get the brick color approved, or you have to get the wood approved, or you have to have all these different things. When does the steel come in? It's the right kind of steel. All those things, the materials, not the labor, but the materials, have to be submitted for approval by the general contractor, the subcontractor, whatever, that they to make sure, and then the architect oversees them, says, yeah, this conforms to what I'm doing in my drawing. There's a schedule for that, of when all those things need to happen. So that's a submittal schedule that's going to be created for a project. And so, obviously, you can't install the brick until it's approved, and you can't approve the brick until it's received by the contractor. And so you have this, I get the bricks, I show it to the architect, I get it approved, then we move forward, and then we install it. So that's what this talks about here. And the schedule, this submittal schedule that's created by the contractor, shall contain the date of the commencement of the work, any interim milestone dates, like specific important dates. We've closed out of the first level. We've closed out of the fifth level for doing the high rise. There's certain milestone dates. Date of substantial completion, when the project can be finished. And then a portion of the work for the construction activities and the time required for completion. So this is like, this part here is specifically just the main project schedule. There's the next provision coming up is the submittal schedule, but this has to be in the main project schedule of when the work is going to be performed. We're going to do this, this, and this over a large project schedule. You may see it as a bar chart. That's the way construction schedules look, like a bar chart. And then the 310-2 is the submittal schedule that I was talking about. So you're going to have two different schedules. You have your construction schedule with 310-1, and 310-2 is the submittals of what, and it'll precede or it'll be in advance. So like if it says installing brick wall on your project schedule between January and February, the submittal schedule, say in October, we're approving brick, so it comes in advance. There's lead time. So the submittal schedule always had lead time to the regular construction schedule.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Is that just to like confirm that the materials was as the architect?
Yeah, it's to confirm, there's a number of them. It's to confirm that it's the materials that were specified in the specifications of the drawings, that they are properly, they look proper. So the architect may walk in and see some of the wood and say, get rid of some of that wood. You know, they may or may not. So there's lots of, it's just to make sure that what's going in was in the intent of the drawings. Because again, we don't draw 100%, so there's some stuff that you have to communicate back and forth between contractor and architect to make sure it's the right stuff. So.
Would there ever be a provision written that an architect would be responsible for
this? So, the answer is there a provision? No, but it's kind of a gray zone because, like, here's an example. I had a project many years ago where there was a series of warping of beams in an attic space. The architect had specified a certain type of timber that had been infused with fire retardant materials. The contractor supplied those fire retardant materials, and the architect looked at them, and it matched the submittal specification of that. So the architect looked and said, yes, this is what I want in this building, this is how it's going to be built. But later it turned out that those the chemical that was infused into these beams were could be toxic, they weren't fire retardant, and they caused the beams to warp. So it was just a bad product all the way around. Contractors like, I did and you approved this, it's not my responsibility. And so the architect was looked at to say, you are responsible for repairing and ripping all this out. Well, because we approved the materials we specified and approved what the contractor put in. The contractor's like, I put in what you told me to, I showed it to you, you said yes, and then I put it in, it's not my problem. What we ended up, luckily in this case, is we had a state-of-the-art defense, and that no one knew that this chemical was going to react this way. It was a 15 or 20-year-old building, and so at the time that they specified, it was a brand new product on the market. And so we couldn't have known the potential. And then insurance came in, and we ultimately settled the case. But that was where the architect's approval wasn't looking to see if it was going to warp or anything else, but they did approve of the materials. So... 310.3, documents and samples to the site. So samples in this case is change orders and other things. You're going to look and approve the samples. So that would be the brick or the wood that I'm talking about. Shop drawings are, if I you approve, I use quotes for approve. Let's say I have a beam and column connection, a column coming up and a beam coming on top of that, and there's the way the bolts go into it. I have designed that as the architect, but how the bolts and how they're put in and what the torque ratio is, or if they're welded or whatever, the metal, the steel manufacturing company that's going to be providing that steel is going to create shop drawings to show where the bolt diagram is and how those welds are going to be or how they're going to be torqued. I, as the architect, will look at those shop drawings and say, this creates a beam and column situation that makes sense to what my drawings are. But I, as the architect, am not approving whether those bolt diagrams are proper, or whether the torque is proper, or whether the welds are proper. So for that instance, the approval is it looks like it will conform, but if it fails because the bolts were not sufficient otherwise, that falls on the subcontractor, not on the contractor. Because the shop drawings looked right, but I don't check the shop drawing creator's math. I don't really go back and double check their engineering. That's what we're talking about here in 312, shop drawings. So we specifically prepared for the work by the contractor and the subcontractor. So these drawings for shop drawings are specifically called for under Article 312 to be done on the construction side. Architect does not create shop drawings. Those are the subcontractors. And you're going to find shop drawings for mechanical, electrical, plumbing, masonry. You can find all different types of subs that are going to prepare shop drawings. And they're the ones that know the field, they know the industry, and they see a drawing, like let's say you see an elevation of a building that has a series of windows with arches, and then the bricks go across, and then more arches, and the bricks go across. That's all you see the design. The mason is going to know,
that if the bricks go around, when it comes down here, is there going to need to be some type of water infiltration system to keep the water, because we have a change in from a horizontal to a vertical to a horizontal, and why the water's going to go, using things called, one thing's called end dams, or different types of flashing. Architects don't design all that stuff necessarily, but the subcontractors will need to do that in their shop drawings. Some architects do get more detailed and do flashing details as well, but you want to have ultimately the subcontractor responsible for those shops. And then the purpose is to demonstrate how the contractor proposes on 312.4, how they propose to conform with the information given and the design concept expressed in the contract documents. So they see something on paper. They know how to build. So their shop drawings are to say how I see this visually to how I'm going to construct it. That's the purpose of a shop drawing. So you can make sure. And then the architect will look at it and say, I think this is going to work or not work, but they are not responsible if the shop drawings aren't correct. And then it talks in 312.5. The contractor shall review. So now the subs have given the shop drawings to the general contractor. Contractors shall review for compliance with the contract documents and approve and submit to the architect. So, sub gives it to contractor, contractor approves it, and gives it to the architect. And this is where a contractor will say, well, I'm just a general contractor, I don't have to know everything. Well, but you do here. You are approving what your sub is giving to the architect. And then it talks about it's in accordance with the submittal schedule, so you have to give it sort of reasonable promptness and sequencing. So you have to have a time period by which the architect has enough time to review it and approve or reject it, and then it goes back, and then you have to do a couple different times of shop drawings reviewed and approved before the construction is being done. That's why if you're going to be building that brick wall between January and February, shop drawing review may start in September, so you have time to go through. And there's a... Sometimes contractors will say turnaround time is X or Y. Here it just says reasonable period of time. And then by submitting the shop drawings, this is 12.6, they represent to the owner and the architect that they have reviewed and approved, determined and verified the materials, and checked and coordinated the information. So here's the general contractor saying, I'm taking responsibility for my subs too. Before I go forward, I have done all this work. So this is very important to allow, to make sure the contractor has done their job. This is to keep the contractor from saying, hey, my subs told me it was fine, and I'm just a paper contractor or whatever. I just signed the checks, so it's not my problem. Well, here this says, no, it is your problem because you reviewed and approved it. 312.7, the contractor shall perform no portion of the work for which the contract documents require submittal and review, and until they have been submittal has been approved by the architect. Now, approval, again, by the architect in this instance isn't I have reviewed the engineering and the math. This is just I've seen it, it conforms with the design intent expressed, and I have approved it for that purposes. I like the color of the brick. I'm not saying the composition of this brick, if it's been properly fired and you got it from a right store and it's not going to crack under heat, it just looks like the brick that I want. That's approval. So if a brick fails, it's not necessarily the architect's fault. Did you have a question?
Yes. So let's say a designer gives feedback and goes through multiple rounds, where it delays construction, and it's just costing money to delay the construction, then who would be at fault there? Would it be like the contractor is not meeting the expectations of the designer?
Yep.
I guess it's kind of fuzzy there.
Like, who's responsible if they have to keep going back to the drawing board over and over, basically? So the answer to that is, in most instances, if you have to go back for approval and approval, in most instances it's going to be the sub and the general contractor is responsible because they had their schedule set up. And there's no defined industry standard, but you may or may not remember in Article 4.2.3 of the B101, it had this thing. It said X number of site visits, X number of reviews of drawings, and X number of times for substantial completion, and those were blank.
What you're going to see traditionally in there is going to be two for review of shop drawings and samples and everything else. So that's not to say it can't be more or less, but generally what I've seen over my 30 years of doing this, this is a couple times review where the architect says, I reviewed it, sent it back, reviewed it, sent it back. If your submittal schedule has enough time built into it in advance of when the work's going to be done, that shouldn't delay the project. But if it keeps coming over and over, unless the design is so complex or it's such a novel thing that the contractor doesn't understand it and they're not communicating that properly with the architect, I would say most of those problems fall on the contractor. Now, if the architect's design is overly complex, or if the architect's answers coming back aren't sufficient, or if the architect is themselves scratching their head and taking too much time in responding, then there's an argument to say that, well, the architect has some responsibility in that too. That, in my observation, that happens less, but it's not to say that I haven't been in scenarios where the architect carries some of the freight of the cost, but neither of those should be on the owner. So, good question. Yes, so where that would come in, so the owner would be cost to delay, but it would probably be for, it would probably, not necessarily the shop drawing itself delayed the project, but I'll give you two examples. So we go back to we go from two baths to three baths. That's going to delay the project, and the owner has caused this delay, and so the owner has to pay for that delay because they decided they want to add a bath. It's not anything code or otherwise, they just want a new bath. So whatever comes into that and the time of getting the materials, maybe it's got this fancy clawfoot tub or whatever it is that they want to put into this bath, and whatever time is built into that, even if it doesn't hit the regular submittal schedule date, the owner's probably going to be responsible for all of that. But, or in a situation where, like, the owner keeps rejecting a light fixture, I don't like that. That's going to be where the owner steps in, and the architect's like, oh, well, what do you think of this? The contractor, oh, now I've seen it, I don't like it. And trust me, there are a lot of owners that do that. I had a client, I loved it. They were like, we are going to do this project. It was an overseas client, and they said, we're going to get this project, and we are not going to let the president of the company come over until we're almost finished because he will change everything. And it will cost us a lot more money. They knew him from other projects, and they're like, it's going to just cost them more money. So, can I die here? Oh, I need to make sure I'm not running out of battery. Hold on. So, yes, you can have a scenario where the owner picks up a cost. You can also have a scenario where the change creates such a intricate design. Hopefully that works. What do we got here? What's that say? No signal. Come on. When a change creates such an intricate design that the architects provide something and they're trying to move it at a rapid pace and then there's a back and forth, and again, you could say whatever that change is. Or maybe it could be even that it's a condition on the site that could require, like, okay, we have this bad soil, or maybe in the example that I talked about, these giant pots that they had to have those trees in, they had to go through redesign, and there we ended up, that one, I think we ended up splitting that three ways between contractor, owner, and architect because of those issues. So, let me get back up here, hold on. Okay. Why is it like that? That's not helpful. Let's do end. Let's try to see if it works this way. Okay, we're back to where it was. 312.10 says, I'm not going to be, it says we don't have to provide professional services under the practice of architecture engineering. This is the contractor saying, I'm not the engineer, I'm not the designer, I'm not providing it. So when the architect says in the B101, I'm not doing these methods, techniques, sequence, and procedures, this is the contractor saying the opposite. I'm not the designer, so I'm not responsible for that. Now, It does say, though, if there's such services are specifically required by the contract documents, you do have to provide engineering. So there are a couple of examples that are commonly transferred. It's called a delegated design from the architect to the contractor. One is shoring and bracing. So when you dig a hole, you need to brace all that dirt from falling in. And like if you're near another building, if you don't have enough proper bracing, their foundation could come into it and cause cracking of the next door neighbors. So that's something that the architect designs where the hole is dug, because that's where the foundations are going to go, but the contractor has to hire the engineer to make sure that those soils are going to be properly shored and braced. So that's where the engineering services are transferred to the contractor. Another one is curtain walls, like these glass curtain walls on all these buildings that you see. Most of those are proprietary. Those are something that the manufacturer of the curtain wall does the design, and they don't let anybody else see it because they're special designs. So curtain walls the engineering will be transferred to the contractor. Last one, fire protection. You see the red tubes in here and everything else. Fire protection companies want to keep their design systems proprietary as well because of the risks and the liabilities. If there's a fire, they want to make sure that their system is always going to work if somebody's not knocking it off or otherwise. So when you design a fire suppression system as an architect, you say it's going to be sprinkled in accordance to code, it's going to be wet system or dry system, and then the contractor has to do, or its subcontractor has to do all the engineering. So those are some three examples of where it will be, the design will be delegated, the architect won't design it, but pretty much everything else is on the designer side, the architect side, and this provision in the beginning, 312.10, says, I'm not the designer. Back half of 312.10 says, unless these sometimes examples come up. Often what I will do is I will, if I know that it's in the design when I draft this provision, I'll put, including shoring and bracing, curtain walls, fire protection system, or otherwise. So. So this talks about 312.10.1, talks about specifying the design criteria. You must have a wet sprinkled system. You must have a dry sprinkled system, whatever it is. So that's the specification. You need to meet this code specification. You need to meet these requirements, but you still have to design it. I want a curtain wall that's got the blue glass, that's going to look like this, and here's the designs of everything else, and it has to connect to this type of superstructure in the building. Now you take care of it from there. So that's what the specifications will say. It's a criteria, a performance specification, as opposed to the detailed design. Detailed design goes to the contractor and its subcontractors. That's 312.10.1. On an architect show... Oh, owner and the architect, so in this case, if the contractor is doing the shoring and bracing, or the fire protection system, whatever it might be, in this case it's the owner and the architect that can rely on the accuracy of what the subcontractor is doing or the contractor is doing. So if you give me information, let's go back to the, I'm going to stick a kitchen in my hotel, and I give the contractor the fire protection system for the entire building, where the connections are coming in and how that fire protection system is working. I'm designing a kitchen and I'm a different designer and a different builder, I get to rely on the information that the contractor gave me from their fire protection company because I'm tapping into that. So, and if it fails, obviously in my kitchen that's a big deal, so I relied on you, so then it becomes the contractor's fault for those design defects as opposed to the kitchen designers. And that's part of what 312.10.2 says. We don't have to worry about use of cider patching and patching, cleaning up, we don't have to worry about, other than just basically saying, got to keep the project site clean. If you cut a hole in a wall, you got to put the drywall back. That's basically what those two provisions are. Royalties, patents, and copyrights. This is a provision that says, if you contractor in building this structure are using a specific type of machine that has a patent that you have to pay a royalty on, or if you're using some type of situation, whatever you're doing that has a copyright or a trademark, if that is happening, that the contractor must use that as part of the work, the contractor has to pay for that. Now, they'll hopefully have built that into the project site, so ultimately the owner's going to pay, but they're responsible for securing those permits, those licenses. Owner says, I'll get you the license to the drawings to build the building. Any licenses you need, contractor, and for royalties and otherwise, you have to take care of that and let us know. That's what 317 says. 318, indemnification. I mentioned this before.
I'm not going to get into, again, a deep discussion about it, because I'm not going to test you specifically on indemnification. But there's a provision in here, just like there, what we talked about that you need for with an architect, is indemnity is a third party. I'm the owner. I have a contract with the contractor. We are first parties, each of us, going back to Harpo and Groucho Marx. The third party over here gets injured. Somebody's walking on the project site and a beam falls on their head. Somebody trips in a hole. Somebody, whatever happens, something blows wind off of a construction site and pierces somebody's car. They have nothing to do with the contract between the owner and the contractor, but that third party sues the owner. Could be because the beam fell off and pierced that car or hit somebody in the head because the contractor didn't properly secure it. They're responsible for safety. Owner's like, I'm not safety, you're safety. That provision told me you're safety and you're responsible for means and methods. I got sued by this third party. Their Lamborghini's destroyed. They got they got killed because a beam hit them in the head, whatever it might be. They're suing me. I'm going to look to you, contractor, to indemnify me, to pick up my cost and whatever has to be paid to this injured party because you failed to perform. That's what 318 says. On a very basic level, that's all you need to know. There's a whole bunch of other stuff in here. I got highlighted words and everything else. Could be included that the subcontractor screw up, but that's what we're doing here in 318.1 and 318.2. It talks about what a claim is and otherwise. But the purpose of that is to make sure that the owner doesn't have to pick up the things for which it was not responsible for, and the third party gets protected because the contractor pays. That's it. Any questions on that? Okay. Architect, Article 4. We're going to try to get through this pretty quickly because I would like to get through it 5 if we can. We've got about 15 minutes, so we'll see if we get this. Duties of the architect, limitations and authority of the architect shall not be restricted or modified without written consent of the owner and the architect. So we know that there are specific responsibilities talked about in here. We're going to go through those responsibilities of the architect. Those responsibilities to the architect are born out of the contract between owner and architect. But we need to let the contractor know what the architect should and shouldn't be doing. So while it talks about in Article 4 what the architect is doing on the project site and what it will do on the project site, it is not creating an obligation for the architect to do that for the contractor. The architect is doing this stuff on behalf of the owner. We're informing it under Article 4. So that's what we have. So we all know what we're doing on the job site. So that's what 412 says. Administration. So I'm going to administer the contract. I'll be the owner's representative. And in this case, I will have the authority on behalf of the owner only to the extent provided in the contract document. So this is similar language in the B101. Only when it says I have the authority to do that. So when you're looking through the H401 and it says architect can do this, has the authority to do that, that's the limited times. And it's, you know, like when we tear down a wall to see what's behind it, proof payment applications, those are the few things that we talked about in the B101. It's mirrored here. I don't have authority questions on the exam for this because we already tested them in the B101. I just want to point out to you this is what they do. So you're not going to be given a question. So project sites happen, architect says X, Y, and Z, contractor does it, was the contractor responsible because they were the owner's agent? We won't cover that for this exam, but I just wanted to say that that's what they're really doing in this instance. They're going to visit sites at intervals appropriate with the stage of the construction, otherwise agreed with the owner to become generally familiar with the progress and quality. All of this language you've seen before. So the purpose under 4322 is to say, read this, and it's going to look exactly like you hopefully remember from the B101. They're not responsible in charge of means, methods, techniques, and sequences. They're not responsible for safety precautions and programs, just like it says on the B101. So now the contractor knows the architect's not responsible for that. That's 422. 423, the architect will keep the owner reasonably informed about the progress, known deviations from the contract documents, most from the construction schedule, defects and deficiencies. Again, this is a mere provision from the B101. So telling the contractor about this question.
Yeah, I'm wondering about the word reasonably. You just gave an example where you said the person that was engaged, they
Correct. So what's reasonable? So reasonable is one of those terms that lawyers love and hate, because what's reasonable to you and what's reasonable to you and what's reasonable to you all may be different. And so what you're trying to do is you try to establish by industry standards of what's reasonable. Sometimes you even put in a reasonable, like if it's a turnaround of a submittal schedule, you say they must do it within 10 days or less. And then you get rid of the reasonableness of it because it's 10 days. So keeping the owner reasonably informed, if I'm at the project site once a week, I should be talking to the owner once a week. If I'm at the project once a month, maybe I talk to the owner twice a month. So it can depend on the situation of what the architect's involvement is. Or if I'm on the project once a week and I see something that's really bad, not only do I want to tell the owner that day, but I say to the owner, I need to be back Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday to make sure it's all right. And by the way, because I only go once a week, you may have to pay me for that. And that's being reasonable. So then the contractor can't say, well, you're only allowed on the site one time because that's what I understand is reasonable. No, sometimes reasonable is they have to be there more. So it's somewhat of a fluid situation, and that's why it can be different for everybody of what's reasonable or not. So, and that would apply, and if it was a suit, if it's the kind of architect, the ownership of the architect says you didn't keep it reasonably informed, you would go through the same analysis. So, communication. This is just a change between the 07 and the 17, which I think is we may have talked about it in B101, I can't remember, but it says, owner and contractor shall include the architect in all communications that relate to the effect of the architect's services. The previous version of this said, all communications must flow through the architect. They must go through the architect, all communication. This says you need to include the architect if it relates to the architect's services. So there's going to be times where the owner is going to be talking to the contractor and the architect may not know about it. And that's where going to questions about returning the submittals and shop drawings and changes in the field. If the owner's starting to act a little rogue and not informing the architect, the contractor still should get paid and the architect shouldn't then be responsible for it. So maybe the owner says do this and screws the project up. Neither the contractor necessarily nor the architect are responsible. But this talks about how the communication, so if it revolves around or involves architect services, they should be included or shall be included, so it's required. And the owner shall promptly notify the architect of the substance of any direct communication between the owner and the contractor, otherwise relating to the project. So these are two obligations that were on the architect before because all information flowed through the architect but have been shifted to the owner. If you want to start getting out there on the project site and directing traffic owner, you can do that, but you have to tell me architect. So this is the provision that changed how the communication went, but protects the architect as well. And then communication between the subcontractors must stay the same as what it was, still has to flow through the contractor. So while the architect and contractor and owner can all talk independently necessarily up here, if anybody's talking to the subcontractor, you have to go through the general contractor. That's a protection for the GC. Architect will review and certify payments amounts due. That's making sure when they submit an invoice and bill, they're going to go through that process. That's 2.5. 2.6, they have the authority to reject the work. The same language as the B101, and one of the few times in the A201 where it says they have the authority. So this we know, if this happens with the contractor can point to this and say, you are the owner's agent because it says you have the authority here. And they will have the authority to require inspections and testing. So a secondary time when the architect says that, contractor gets paid for it because they are the owner's agent. It also has the same kind of get out of jail, neither this authority nor decision made in good faith will make the architect liable, so the same type of language we saw earlier. Architect will review all drawings, and submittals, shop drawings and data, you've seen that before, so 3.4.2.7, review of submittals is not conducted for the purposes of determining the accuracy and completion of the other details, dimensions, quantities, or for installation procedures or performances. So that middle section here is talking about, I will review it and I will approve it, but I am not checking the math. I am not checking the procedures and how you do it. It looks like what it should be, but
that you did the engineering. So this is the get out of jail free card for the architect. And then it shall not also, this to protect even more the architect, it shall not relieve the contractor, that review shall not relieve the contractor of the obligations under section 3.3, 3.5, and 3.12, meaning contractor still has to perform its job. 3.5 is that warranty, 3.3 is I'm going to perform to the contract documents. I'm blanking on 3.12 right now, but that regardless of what the architect does, contractor still has to comply with the contract here. And it's not an approval of safety precautions mean method, same as you just saw in the B101. That's 3.427. 4.28, they will prepare change orders and constructive change directives and may order minor changes in the work. In Article 7, we'll talk about those a little bit more. But it's the architect that prepares these change order documents. The contractor says, I want more money. The actual physical document of approving that, those will be prepared by the architect. And then the architect under 429 will instruct inspections to determine dates of substantial completion, again, when payment is, when warranties and retainages or lease, some other stuff. We'll talk about that more under Article 9 next week, or 2 weeks from now. But these are the architect's kind of jobs, and remember, these are all in the B101. They will provide more than one representative to do carrying out the architect's responsibilities, so the contractor knows somebody will be on the project site, one or more. They will, under 4211, they will interpret, decide matters concerning the performance under. This is this initial determination, initial decision maker, that they're going to look at it and they're going to decide matters of how it's going to work, 4211. 4212, interpretations or decisions from the architect will be consistent with the intent of and reasonably inferable from the contract documents and will be in writing or in the form of documents, or drawings. So, and that's an instance where it could be the initial decision maker where there's a dispute, or it could be where the contractor says, I'm looking at your drawings. I think this is what I'm supposed to build, but I'm not sure. Can you clarify for me? That's what's called a request for information or an RFI. So the architect is going to review that request for information, and they're going to respond in writing to clarify that. That's where, here's what the contract documents mean. Maybe my drawings weren't complete enough, or maybe you need more detail. So that's what's happening under 4212. 4213, decisions relating to aesthetic effects. Anything visual, the architect is final. They get the final call. So if the contractor puts up a cabinet and it looks perfect and the architect comes in and says, it's a little crooked, they get the final to say. And the contractor says, are you kidding me? I can't see that. And the architect measures it out and it's an 8-foot cabinet row and from one side to the other is a 1/4-inch difference. The architect can say, that's aesthetic, 1/4-inch is too much, you have to rehang it. Now there may be a claim later on for the $5,000 to rehang those cabinets and say the 1/4-inch is within industry standard and tolerances, and so somebody has to pay for that and I don't pay for it. So there could be dispute whether the architect's aesthetic vision was correct, but it's still final as far as the work being performed. Who pays for it may be battled later. And then under 4214, they review, respond, request for information, that's the RFI process they talk about. And they have to respond and reply within certain time limits. And it is time, so we will not get through subcontractors. So we're stopping at 4. We still will get through, I promise, we will still get through all the rest of it the next session in 2 weeks. Let me turn my mic off. I know I went through Article 4 pretty quickly. The reason why...